Rerun,
I think.
We're on. Oh, wow, icon. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you today to the May 26, 2010 meeting of, or joint meeting of the Senate Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs with our House compatriots. And we're going to have a very full agenda today dealing with a host of veterans issues and then moving on into emergency preparedness issues as well. So very full agenda. And Representative Callan, would you like to add anything?
Well, I think we both have to officially gavel.
We do. There we go. Let me hand it over. Okay.
I would like to open this meeting of the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Services.
Yes. So good morning, everyone. I'm going to hand this over very quickly to our competent staff person here, Bill Taylor, who will review the agenda for us at this point in time.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have before you the agendas of the Senate Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs and the House Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs and Emergency Preparedness. We will start off this morning with informational meetings on TRICARE and with invited testimony covering the Oregon National Guard men and women, coverage of veterans, coverage veterans who are state employees, and I believe Senator Morissette had a particular interest in that issue. Then we have review of veterans issues, which will be the three task forces that the legislature created last session: task force on veterans transportation, task force on women's veterans health care, and report on the reintegration task force. Then we have military families with invited testimony from Stacey Bannerman. And then we have today Jason Leon, who spent a tour in Iraq with the infantry and was a member of the Oregon National Guard and was going to tie it up with the infantry in Iraq, and he'll talk about his experience there and also his experiences of when he came back to Oregon into the community. Then we start the part of the meeting that technically is part of the House agenda, but probably something the senators would be interested in hearing too, and that's emergency preparedness. First off, we'll hear the statutory basis for government response to emergencies under Chapter 401 and then Chapter 433. One relates to natural disasters, the other relates to pandemics. And then we'll have agency reports and preparedness plans from the Oregon Military Department, Department of Human Services, the State Police, and Department of Transportation. In September, we'll hear from two additional agencies. And then we'll also have a report on the preparedness, including the social distancing project, which would deal with an issue of pandemic. And finally, from Legislative Council's office, we'll have a basic overview and report on SJR 6 from the 2007 session, which would be a revision to the Oregon Constitution to deal with issues that probably the founding fathers of the state never thought about, and that is what happens if you have a major natural disaster. And, for example, the legislature needs to meet but can't meet because this building is not standing, and many of the members can't get here. And that would require not one amendment to the Constitution, but several, and consequently it would have to be a revision to the Oregon Constitution.
We're going to solve that today, right?
We're going to solve lots of problems today. Well, as you can see, ladies and gentlemen, we have a very, very full agenda. So let's just move ahead very quickly. And we have an informational meeting with TRICARE. And we do have invited testimony. I'd like to get started, though, with Mr. Mann and General Caldwell. And I do believe that we have representatives from TRICARE here today as well that would like to testify. So can Mr. Mann and General Caldwell approach the approach the podium. Okay. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. And with us today, of course, Tom's here. I could throw him under the bus and say, talk, Tom, but I think what you really want to talk about was what's going on, or what you want to get updated on what's going on with TRICARE and how that situation is working with respect to our soldiers. And with us today we have Mike Hanley with the with the TriWest, which is the contractor for TRICARE for the Oregon National Guard for the West Coast. So I think it'd probably be just as well if I didn't waste your time and got Mike up here and we could start moving through that. And I think that would probably be my recommendation.
Sounds like a plan, because Mr. Mann, you will be speaking later, I know, too.
Yes,
thank
ma'am.
You. Great. Okay, Mr. Hanley.
Do you have somebody else with you?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yep. I'd like to bring up Bill Cahill.
And the bill is also with Tri-West Healthcare Alliance. And just for the record, I'm the service area director for Tri-West, so I'm basically the field operations guy for Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and about half of Washington. And Bill is our director of our Washington, D.C. office, so I'm going to turn it over to him to provide a general overview of Tri-West and the TRICARE program.
For the record, Mr. Hanley, could you get your name into the tape?
I'm sorry. Oh, Mike Hanley.
Thank you.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is William Cahill, and as Mike mentioned, I have the privilege of being the director of the Washington, D.C. office for Tri-West Healthcare Alliance. And what that, why that brings me here is I'm essentially the policy person that kind of works with the federal government in helping to address issues and challenges around the operations of the TRICARE program that Tri-West is privileged to administer in 21 states across the western United States. So what I thought I would do is as the slides in front of you might suggest, is give you some overview of the TRICARE program and of Tri-West Healthcare Alliance and who we are and some of the special things that we think we bring to the people of Oregon and the members of the Guard and the Reserve who live here, active duty and retirees as well. And then Mike is going to talk just a bit about what we do specific to Oregon for members of the Oregon Guard and distinguished generals, folks here on the ground. And then, obviously, if there are any questions or concerns, we can address them. We're here for that. So that, I'll just get started since you all have a very full agenda. The TRICARE program, as some of you may know, is a military health care entitlement program, and it's offered to members of the active duty service, their families, retirees, their families, and members of the reserve component and their families, certain members of the reserve component and their families. The TRICARE program is broken up into three regions. They are, and Mike can put the slide up there for me, you'll see they are the West region, the North region, and the South region. It's basically three administrative contractors. Yes,
the I'm West sorry is that. Some of that is not West in our book.
We got the long straw on this one, but we are very pleased. We run or assist the government in providing the TRICARE benefit in 21 states, as you can see, and we go as far west as Hawaii and as far west by the federal government's definition of the Mississippi River. And we do a very little small piece of Texas. We don't want to take out those wonderful people in El Paso and Fort Bliss. But as you can see, we are privileged to work in the state of Oregon as well. There are about 71,000 TRICARE beneficiaries in the state of Oregon that we are privileged to work with the government in assisting to provide their health care. Tri-West itself is not the same thing as TRICARE. TRICARE is the government program. Tri-West is a private company that serves as what they call the healthcare support contractor, and I'll explain a bit about what that means. Tri-West has about 1,700 employees in 21 states, and we do have a few great, wonderful citizens of Oregon who work for us in a few areas that Mike will discuss with you when he talks about the care we provide here in Oregon. Tri-West is owned by 16 not-for-profit healthcare organizations and two nonprofit university hospital systems in the state we serve. And our owners serve as the contract workers that help work with our physicians and get providers into the network that we provide for TRICARE beneficiaries. Our network across the 21 states is about 150,000 providers, and that is continuing to grow, frankly, on a regular basis, which is a wonderful thing. And even in Oregon here, as you'll see in the slide there, we have about 11,707 providers. I say about because that does change on a daily basis, upwards and occasionally downwards, although not very often. And that has gone up about 25% over the last 5 years, which we are proud to see that we've working more aggressively in Oregon, and that's great. I mentioned that Tri-West is the health services and support contractor. And what that essentially means is we provide five basic services to the TRICARE program. We manage and coordinate the medical services. We develop and build and maintain a healthcare provider network. We process and pay claims for the network. We process the program enrollment applications and manage the customer service interactions, which is, I think, very important. And then last but certainly not least, and I saved it for last because it's an emphasis that we certainly have here and elsewhere, is we educate the beneficiaries of this program on what they have access to, where they can get it, and how they can obtain it. The TRICARE program has basically two options with a third little kicker option that you can use. You can either use TRICARE Prime, which is an HMO-style healthcare system, managed care with referrals and a closed network of doctors that you can access. That program is available to people who live in the prime service areas, and Mike will discuss, Oregon has an extensive prime service area network, which is great. And the other type is TRICARE Standard, which is the traditional indemnity care that probably many of us grew up with, where you just go to any doctor you want and they send you the bill. There is a kicker to that kind of program called TRICARE Extra, which is kind of the version of a PPO, for those of you familiar with that style. So it's go wherever you want to, but if you go to a network person, there's a little benefit to you. You pay a little less out of pocket. So it's a preferred provider organization type of program. There are additional and different programs, most specifically, which many of you may hear about, called TRICARE for Life, which is the program for retirees over age 65, or essentially TRICARE for Medicare-eligible persons. That program actually is managed by a different company as a nationwide contract. It's managed by an organization called Wisconsin Physician Services. TriWest tries to take a few extra steps in working with some of the populations that are very important to us and special from the nature of their service, not the least of which is the preserve and guard components. As all of you know, and as General Caldwell can certainly attest to, they have a more difficult time in some ways accessing benefits and services. They come from different communities from around great vast states. They coalesce, they deploy, they come back, and they disperse again. Not to a base, not the traditional base support structure around them. So TriWest has tried to create a series of services to specifically reach out to those components of our service. We have a special online place where reserve and guard members can go to receive information. If you go to TriWest.com, you'll find a whole special portal for members of the guard and reserve, giving them access to special types of information important to them. We do special reserve component briefings all across the Western United States with reserve components, and Mike will talk a lot about what we've done in the Oregon area in that. We do some special yellow ribbon reintegration programs, which are for those guys when they come back, men and women, I should say, when they come back. And we provide extensive support for the reserve component units and families, too, while they're gone. We try to sponsor a few events and activities that bring the families together when their husbands or wives or sons or daughters are deployed, to keep some camaraderie and harmony in an otherwise dispersed group of folks. Certainly special on the mind these days of many service members, their families, and elected officials, such as members of this committee, is behavioral health services. TriWest has a number of special resources available for behavioral health care, including a separate program of assistance, which is available online, very important for persons who live in remote areas. You can even receive online counseling using Skype. It's actual video counseling with a licensed provider, where you can sit in your home and use a web camera and get counseling with a licensed provider. Very important, as I said, for those either who are working, busy. It's 24/7, 365 available. We're very proud of that. We have resource centers and libraries, and we have distributed, and we think this has been a especially helpful, a cadre of help items called the Help from Home DVD series. And we recently produced a special one for the 41st Brigade as it came home, which, while minimal in effort, I think creates a very maximal experience for those persons like the 41st, because we have a special outreach to them. The video starts by saying, "Welcome home, members of the 41st. It's not just a generic briefing, it's to them, it's talking to them, it gets a little specific to where they were and what they did overseas, and I think helps to get them interested in paying attention to what they're eligible for, which is important to us. And then we do a little bit of more specialized customer outreach. We have dedicated staffing to support and educate beneficiaries all across the country. We have special support for non-traditional military units, which is to say one of the big ones have been recruiters, who tend to be out in the field, far away from support systems, SEALs, Special Forces, who just experienced totally different deployment cycles and have needed a little bit of extra help, and we're very proud of that. And finally, I'd say we have a high-profile case support system, which helps us to work with complex healthcare cases for wounded warriors, survivor families, which are an extraordinarily challenging group who have suffered the ultimate sacrifice of losing a loved one in combat in this country. And we continue to outreach on a regular basis to those folks to make sure they don't lose touch with the program that is so important to them in their health care. So with that, I'd like to turn over to Mike, who can talk a lot more about what we do specifically in Oregon. Again, it's my privilege, and thank you so much for your time and attention this morning.
Good morning. As I mentioned, my name is Mike Hanley, and I'm the Service Area Director for Oregon, Idaho, Eastern and Southern Washington, and Montana. And what I do is manage the operational, basically the workings of the program in those four states. And so we have a great group of folks that help us do that. And so I just want to talk a little bit about specifically here in Oregon. the current contract started in April of 2004. And so we put in place the Northwest Market Area, which at that time included Oregon, Washington, and a small portion of northern Idaho. In November of last year, that expanded to include Idaho and Montana. So as you can see, I have TRICARE, manage the TRICARE service centers and programs in Fairchild Air Force Base in Spokane, Yakima, and then in November, Mountain Home Air Force Base, Malmstrom Air Force Base, and then also here specifically in Oregon, we have TRICARE service centers co-located with the Coast Guard air groups in Astoria and North Bend. We also have a TRICARE service center in Lake Oswego, and proud to say, we also have the only TRICARE, dedicated TRICARE office in the country co-located with the National Guard headquarters here in Salem. So, and that was put in place about 3 years ago. So our job is to provide walk-in assistance, but we also have call centers that with folks, and our local one is in Tacoma, Washington, where somewhat our regional office, and they have folks there that answer our 800 line. They also process authorizations and referrals for care and a number of other things. In terms of structure, our vice president and my boss is George Cargill, a retired 27-year Army colonel. And then Rick Becker, who was my contemporary, who's a retired 30-year Navy captain. And Rick primarily manages the program in and around the Puget Sound in northwestern Washington. So across the other four states, I've got all the geography and all the rest. So that's our management team. Again, when we talk about TRICARE service centers, we're there to assist people that walk in, and I'll go a little bit more specifically in some of the things that we do. And we also have links to our regional office where if we need to access healthcare services, that we can do that. And we don't have, just to contrast the difference in TRICARE service centers and programs, the TRICARE program, most people think of it as a health insurance program, and it's really not. It's a government entitlement program. And really, the design of the program was to augment the care and build civilian provider networks outside and around military installations. So when I talk about places like Fairchild Air Force Base, Mountain Home Air Force Base, and Malmstrom Air Force Base, that's the traditional composition and structure of our support. Those offices are managed by nurses, so there is that healthcare presence there locally, and then TRICARE service reps who handle the folks that come in and with the walk-in services. Here in Oregon, I have one-person locations except for Portland where I have two. So there is no nursing presence. These are TRICARE service reps, but they have a direct line to a nurse who basically is a phone call away in terms of if something needs a clinical view or research, that we have that access to us almost immediately. And as I mentioned, they provide the face-to-face customer service. They research claims issues, eligibility verification. They process enrollments and general benefits education. And the enrollment is the day-to-day folks that are wanting to either enroll in the TRICARE Reserve Select Program or the TRICARE Prime or Prime Remote program. What they also do, is, and it's very important, is they also work and help process large numbers of enrollment applications when we have units deploying and redeploying who are entitled to active duty health care benefits. And so when we talk about a brigade deployment, where you're talking approximately 3,000 or so military service members and their family members, they and their family members are currently eligible for 90 days of health care benefits, active duty, the time that they're deployed, and then 180 days or 6 months when they return. Under the National Defense Authorization Act of 2010, we're expecting sometime this year that that front-end benefit is going to change from 90 days to 180 days. So service members and family members will have 6 months of active duty benefits prior to, during the deployment, and then 6 months afterwards. So when that happens, when we're talking about a brigade deploying, we're enrolling those family members, if that's their choice, into TRICARE Prime and Prime Remote. So we're talking about hundreds or thousands of enrollment forms that are flowing through our offices here in Oregon to get them processed and working with our enrollment department in Phoenix. To give you an idea, when the 81st Brigade deployed out of Washington a couple years ago, we did 620 applications when they deployed. A year ago, when the 41st Brigade deployed, we did approximately 2,800 enrollment applications. And then when those soldiers and family members come back, then they have to re-enroll because it's a different program that they're in for the 180 days when they return. So right now we're working probably close to about 2,000 enrollment applications for those service members and family members that are coming back. We also have our eye on the future in that currently on the 17th of September we'll have the 116th Brigade deploying. And that one's a little bit more challenging because two-thirds of the brigade is located in Idaho. We have a battalion, the 3rd of the 116th, located in La Grande, and we have a battalion, the 1st of the 163rd, located in Belgrade, Montana. So on that deployment, we're actually working across three states. And all those enrollment applications are beginning to flow, and they will be consolidated and processed here in our Salem office. So we're very, very busy in terms of enrolling folks and making sure that they get their benefits. In terms of walk-in services and who we deal with, most folks look at us as supporting the Guard, which we do, and they are here in Oregon, the big kid on the block. But also, there's a lot of other folks that have military affiliations. We want to make sure that we're also supporting the Navy Reserve, Marine Corps Reserve, Coast Guard Reserve, recruiters. We also support the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. We even have some NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration folks on the coast that we support. We also support and provide health care for folks, U.S. public health folks, located inside and outside of the Indian reservations as well. So we have a nice variety of folks that we support, and although they're all the same, they're all different, and we try to meet their needs. In terms of education, just in the last year, we supported approximately 288 events. Sometimes those are structured events where we're supporting an organization that has asked for a pre-deployment briefing or a post-deployment briefing or a during-deployment briefing or just a general TRICARE briefing on folks' TRICARE benefits. Sometimes those are events like VA stand-downs, job fairs that we also support, and veterans events where we are working with the VA. And I would say that we're very closely linked in with both the VA hospitals in Portland and in Roseburg. We deal with them on a daily basis, specifically in terms of Wounded Warrior, those folks that, you know, our concern is somebody gets sent from Walter Reed or one of the other major military installations and they come into Oregon and we don't know about it. So we're touching base with the VA almost on a weekly basis to make sure nobody falls through the crack. And what we typically do is match up their case manager with ours to make sure that the VA is providing and coordinating that service member's service-connected care and that we're providing their standard care and the care for their families. Another example of where we try to go out and support is last spring when the 41st Brigade was doing their pre-deployment training down at Camp Roberts, California. I was actually down there the first 2 weeks, and what we did is established a cell down there to work in conjunction with the 41st to, even though that's a Tri-West area, going down into, with the local providers to make sure that the care was lined up, that they knew that Oregon was there. Most importantly, what we wanted to do is we didn't, they have states coming from, National Guard organizations coming and reserve organizations coming from other regions. They come, they get their care, and they leave, and then the providers are left to struggle with the claims 3, 6 months, a year afterwards. And so why we established a presence down there was to ensure that when the 41st Brigade came, that the care that they needed out in the civilian network was provided, and then also that all those claims issues were worked and resolved and paid prior to us leaving. And that was very positive with the providers that that were down there. We also opened the, helped open the troop medical clinic where we had a civilian doctor. It was part of Madigan and their staff, and they provided all the initial care, and then we coordinated all the care that was downtown, and that was a very successful effort. In terms of prime service areas, we have six here in Oregon, mostly centered around where our locations are. And what that means is service members and family members that enroll in the TRICARE Prime Remote Program don't necessarily have to go see a contracted provider, one of our contracted providers. And that's primarily in those gray areas that you see, central and eastern Washington. Those that reside in or near our prime service areas where we have built those networks are required to see one of our contracted providers. That also has a direct impact on retirees in that if they want to participate in the TRICARE Prime program under 65, that they need to receive their care, be enrolled to one of our contracted providers, and receive that care within the prime service area. So if we have retirees that live maybe 50 or 80 miles away and they want to be enrolled in the TRICARE Prime program, then we have to get them enrolled to a contracted provider in that area. And it allows them to participate in the program. I will show you some other states to give you an idea of how robust the program is here in Oregon and across the states that we serve. When you look at states like Montana or Idaho or Minnesota, or Iowa, which are similar, the last two being similar to Oregon, you have one prime service area that has been designated around a major metropolitan area. And if you contrast that to what we have here in Oregon, I would say we have a very robust program, and we offer the TRICARE Prime benefit and Prime Remote benefit to quite a number of retirees. And as Bill said, we have a very extensive network to be able to provide that care. In terms of folks here in Oregon who participate in the program, close to 72,000, 71,000, and this is a breakdown. There obviously are different divisions within these. These are just the global environments, but approximately 6,000 active duty service members, close to 12,000 active duty family members, 26,000, 27,000 retirees and family members, and then 26,000 approximately members in the TRICARE for Life. And in terms of the TRICARE Reserve Select Program, which was established a few years ago, we have close to 1,000 service members and family members that are enrolled in that program as well. As I mentioned, a couple of benefits that are coming as a this year as a part of the NDAA for 2010. One of those is the 90 days of pre-benefit care for deploying Guard members and family members being extended from 90 days prior to deployment to 180 days. One of the other provisions is mandatory prior and after deployment mental health screenings. And then one of the things that concerns that people had voiced were those traditional Guard members who retired from the Guard as a traditional Guard member at, let's say, maybe age 40, 35, 40, 40 in their early 40s, but their retirement benefits, full retirement benefits, did not kick in until they turned 60. So there was really no provision for them to participate in the TRICARE program. And so part of the program that's being implemented this year will allow them something similar to the TRICARE Reserve Select Program, where they will pay a monthly fee and they'll be allowed to enroll in our TRICARE standard program. So now what we will have is for traditional Guard members a program and then be able to participate in TRICARE not only during their traditional role as a Guards person, but also between that time that they retire and they receive their full retirement benefits at age 60. And that's all I have.
Madam,
any questions?
Yes, Senator Morissette.
The agenda also includes a portion on veterans who are state employees, and that's my interest. I have a constituent who has had problems. He's employed. PEB covers him. There's been some discussion between the governor's office and PEB. I understand the attorney general, DOJ, rendered an opinion that had a negative impact on coverage of veterans who work for the state. So do you know anything about that?
So I apologize, sir. Senator, the short answer is there is no difference from an eligibility perspective for TRICARE for a state employee.
Yeah, from your perspective.
Yes, sir. Yeah. The TRICARE program at all does not recognize any difference. The VA healthcare system may have some differences in how they're treating state retirement insurance or anything of that nature. The only interactive wrinkle I could see with the TRICARE program is the federal government's requirement about, I'll call it, harmonization of other health insurance. So who's the first guy getting pointed at when you walk into a hospital?
Yeah.
And that issue,
I
want
to know.
Yeah. Is that the issue that was raised? Yes.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chairman,
the problem.
Or Madam Chairman, Senator Morissette, as I understand it, federal government says if you have health care coverage from your employer, you will use that and not disregard that and go to TRICARE, even though you are capable or eligible for TRICARE. You have to use your employer's health care first. That's a federal determination. I think that's what the Attorney General held in his opinion on that, because we've got several employees that fall into that category that they wanted to drop their PEB insurance, get the money instead in their paycheck, and then take
that
TRICARE.
So now I see the issue. I apologize, Senator. I didn't quite understand the nature of the issue here. But the issue is the federal government prohibits employers from offering inducements to employees to use TRICARE. And the genesis of that policy is, and I don't want to throw the distinguished company under the bus, but a company in the United States was saying to its service members, hey, we'll give you a little extra scratch if you get off of our employer-provided plan and go let the federal government take care of you. And this company was quite large, and we were talking thousands of people. They were, I'll use the term lightly, encouraging quite heavily to go on to the TRICARE program instead of using the employer-provided plan. That said, the only prohibition is offering inducements. There is no prohibition if the employee himself or herself would like to choose the TRICARE program as their primary provider. That's absolutely their right as an eligible beneficiary, assuming all eligibilities are met. That's absolutely their right. What is not allowed is for the state to say, and we'll take what we normally were going to pay you for your health insurance and put that right in your paycheck. No employer in the country can do that as of this time. That's the difference. So thank you, General. Thanks. I hope that answers your question, Senator.
Senator Boquist has a follow-up.
Follow-up. Let's say, for example, which is pretty common in Oregon, you have the spouse or on one side or the other, whatever. One of them has PEB, right? One of them's eligible for TRICARE. And so they have both, say, PEB and TRICARE, right? You sign up. Obviously, my assumption is the first payer is PEB. Under the federal law.
Yes, sir.
But if there's any supplemental or any additional cost, then that falls to TRICARE. Is that not
correct?
Yes, sir.
Correct?
That helps clarify. No,
that
helps.
Yeah. Great. Thank you, Senator.
Representative Cowan, did you have a question?
Thank you, Senator. Yes, I do. And we're going to try to keep this to another couple minutes, so I'll be brief. Could you help me understand a little bit about that gray area on the map?
Oh,
just happens to be my district. It's one of those gray areas. Individuals, how does it work? Help me understand how it works for individuals who are because of their service, eligible for TRICARE. And then the second part of my question has to do with the provider reimbursement rates, how those compare across the spectrum. In other words, if it's not part of a plan, a contracted plan, providers then, for example, in my area, would have the option of accepting a TRICARE insurance or not accepting it, and usually that's based on the rates that are paid. So I'd like to understand how that works a little better.
Okay. Do you want to talk about gray area or you want me to?
That's fine. In terms of, we refer to the gray area.
It's from her district. I'm going to put you onto this bus.
Oh, that's fine. Not a problem.
And much of the rest of the state, I might add.
Yes, ma'am. Yes. The three programs that were discussed, TRICARE Prime, TRICARE Extra, and TRICARE Standard, and I don't know if your question is related from a more retiree perspective. No, it's not. Okay. Is that for active duty service members, those are full-time Guard members who and their families that are located in those areas, they can enroll in TRICARE Prime Remote. And so they are not assigned a provider, nor do they have to go see a contracted provider. Their claims will still pay as if they were in a prime service area. For more traditional Guard members that have enrolled in our TRICARE Reserve Select program, basically what they are purchasing is TRICARE Standard. So they pay a monthly fee, and they pay 20% of the cost or the reimbursement rate that TRICARE would pay to that provider. So if they went and saw a non-contracted provider, which they do not have to see, they just have to see a TRICARE certified provider, and if that provider accepts assignment, then if TRICARE pays $100 to the provider for the service, then the member is responsible for $20, and TRICARE pays $80. For retirees, it works the same way in that they have the choice of TRICARE Standard or Extra. Now, if in that area we do have contracted providers, and I'll use Bend as an example, the TRICARE Reserve Select service and family members and retirees go to one of our contracted providers, then instead of paying 20% of the TRICARE reimbursement rate, they'll pay 15%. Did that answer your question?
Yes, it did. A brief follow-up. Are you finding, as a general rule, that the non-contracted providers in the rural areas are willing to accept TRICARE insurance?
Yes, and one of the things that if we do have a non-contracted provider that does not accept assignment, but as an incentive for them to see our patients, they can do what's known as balanced billing, where they can take and bill TRICARE for an additional 15% above the TRICARE maximum allowable, and TRICARE will take and pay that as an incentive in those remote areas to see and treat our patients. In terms of your question, in terms of reimbursement rates, we're pretty consistent with the Medicare rates, so that is a challenge. And one of the things that we talk to the providers about, and I think one of the reasons why we have such a vast network is we have a lot of patriotic providers out there that are willing. They want to do something to give back, contribute to the service, the people that are serving their country. So we have a lot of our providers who contract with us and are part of our network who want to do something to help service members and retirees.
Thank you. I can appreciate that, and I appreciate those providers' willingness. The reality of our rural health care system is that it's way too heavily balanced on Medicare, Medicaid-type rates and payments versus private pay, and our rural providers are having a very difficult time staying afloat financially. So patriotism is a wonderful thing, and we all appreciate that on this panel. We'd also like to see our providers be able to make a living and stay in business.
I will add one other thing.
There are special Medicare payments for, access hospital, critical access hospitals.
We understand that. We're getting into a whole other health
care. TRICARE does pay that as well.
Okay.
We do pay up to that level, so I just wanted to add that. I'm sorry.
We do need to move along. I think Representative Escobedo.
Yes, kind of ties in with Senator Morsett's situation there. So what you're telling us is the federal government prohibits me from using my TRICARE and having my employer, which is the state of Oregon, reimburse me that $150 a month. So then I have to sign up with the state of Oregon at $1,000 a month at the cost of the taxpayer. Is that what you're telling me?
The federal government does not prohibit you from signing up for the TRICARE program.
I understand that.
But what prohibits the state of Oregon from reimbursing you for having paid it.
So in other words, it's prohibited that it's costing the state of Oregon $850 a month because of a federal law.
Regulation.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's costing.
There's a law. I think it's a regulation.
Wow. I just wanted to clarify that.
So I imagine that that's something that needs to be addressed at the federal level.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say beyond our control.
Yeah. How great. Marvelous.
Madam Chair, do you have some insight there?
I think that there will be some discussions this weekend.
Madam Chair, I just want to make one comment in reference what Chair Cowan brought up with rural providers, and I think Representative Stigler was a leader in our problem over in Bend, Central Oregon. We have a fair number of providers in the Central Oregon area. We were sending a battalion off to war, but we didn't have any contractor providers, and the representative and I worked together. She put together a group of healthcare providers over there now. I don't know the number, but it's, what, Mike, 150 providers over there in the Bend area now?
Currently, but as I mentioned to Representative Stigler, and I mentioned to you, we have already contracted Bend Memorial.
Right.
So we'll probably be adding about another 120, 130 providers there in Bend.
And I might also say that I think the selling point, and Representative, you can correct me if I'm wrong, because she put this thing together, made it all happen for us, which we're very, very grateful. One of the selling points was that when many of the myths that were in play based on the old system that was CHAMPUS called, were dispelled, and the providers realized that most often if they were signed up in the system working with TriWest, that they would get payment within 7 to 10 days of the time they billed.
Yeah.
Automatic payment. Suddenly that lower rate, even though it wasn't the best rate, they had cash flow issues that they could react to very quickly thanks to the way TriWest does business. And I think that was probably the main selling point of why we were able to get these people.
Madam Chair, if I just might real quickly,
I'd
like to add in here that once I contacted TriWest and worked with the general here and got that conversation going, it was amazing how providers, their response to the whole situation. And what I found was that TriWest, TriCare were very willing to have those conversations. The problem is, you know, people just automatically go directly to, well, this is a problem, nobody wants to respond to it, without bothering to say, is there a way to, you know, get the conversation started? So it was, I applaud all of those folks sitting up there at that table and their cooperation in resolving this.
Great. Thank you. Do you have one final question?
Just very quickly, in the news in the last 2 months, the Department of Defense, especially the Army, has been quite vocal in that soldiers need to start paying for their own health care. So has TRICARE heard any of those rumors, any indication of what's coming down there? I know there were some serious heat rounds to the Secretary of Army on that, but they are continuing to study of ways to make soldiers pay for part of their own health care. So have you heard anything, any impact? Or?
It is clear to me. First of all, the rates, the premiums paid by retirees and is what the basic issue is, retirees under 65. And it is clear to me that the Secretary of Defense and, frankly, each of the service chiefs from the Commandant of the Marine Corps, the Chief of Staff of the Army, are all intending to make the rate of premium for TRICARE Prime an issue. It's $460 per year for family coverage, and it has been that same rate for 14 years. And so they have thrown that issue out there. I should note that TriWest does not set that rate. We have nothing to do with it. We collect it administratively, but that's all we have to do with it. But I would expect that with that level of attention from the persons giving it, it won't go unnoticed. Although the House Armed Services Committee just recently prohibited the increase for another year. So Schrader, you can raise that one as well.
Okay, thank you. It's just very fascinating for me to have this inside connection.
A new sort of list.
And I have to do two different lists now. I do have one question. I hope I'm not opening up a can of worms with this for General Caldwell. And I do apologize. We are going to have to move ahead, and I know Tom will get us back on time when he comes up. There were some issues at Fort Lewis, General, and how does that interrelate with TRICARE and Big Army and what some of the, I guess there were some issues that needed to be addressed on who was taking care of who at what time?
Now, Madam Chair, members of the committee, indeed, we experienced some issues with the out-processing of our soldiers in the 41st Brigade. And the short version is this, is that we believe, and I think now the Big Army in Fort Lewis have recognized, I don't think I know, that they have recognized that they misinterpreted what was explained earlier in the TAMP program, which is the aftercare, the 180-day care. In essence, they were putting soldiers through the medical out-processing who had injuries that, in our view, and I think now the Army's view, needed to be fixed there. They would be remained on Title 10 active duty until they were repaired, their surgeries were done, their rehab completed, and then released from active duty. Instead, they were pushing them out the door. They were not serious injuries, but they were nonetheless an injury where they couldn't physically go back to work if, in fact, they had a job. And so they were saying, you go to the VA or go to TRICARE and have them fix it. Well, that wasn't at all what TAMP was designed to do. The TAMP 180-day period post-deployment was designed for just normal health care, you know, colds, flus, that sort of thing, not for service-related injuries. And so we, the thing, as you saw probably in the news, and Congressman Schrader was active in getting his staff up there to find out what was going on. Frankly, we were... The unfortunate thing about demobilization is that when you demob in cycles and groups, and the leadership of the organization was demobbing where these 185 people were left back because of these medical things. The gate came open, they went over there, yet the whole brigade went home because that's what they do. They get you out of there in 7 days. And so we didn't have adequate leadership up there. That's a hit on us. We didn't catch it quick enough. We did catch it thanks to the good work of your husband's office and Senator Wyden's office, and we re-energized it. I think the Army has taken it extremely seriously. I don't think I know they have. They sent the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army and the Surgeon General of the Army to Fort Lewis to review these processes, and the one thing that they all agreed on from the Pentagon down was that TAMP was not designed to fix soldiers who were injured on active duty. That wasn't the purpose. The result of that is that all 185 of the people that were cut out early and the ones that were remaining, a total of 185, about 100 of them had already been cut out and sent home. All cases are being reviewed again. I think this week we sent another 12 or 14, and Colonel McCray can probably tell you the exact number, back to Fort Lewis, put them back on Title 10, and they're going to be getting health care services at Fort Lewis, Madigan, to get their issues resolved. So we're on the fix. The Army's leaned forward. They did a masterful job, I think, in partnerships with us to try to fix this problem. They didn't ignore it, and we're very pleased with the outcome so far. Now, that doesn't mean that every one of these 185 are going to have a good story to tell, but I can tell you that the leadership right now is fully engaged, and we're completely engaged in making sure that the processes get done properly and according to the way Congress intended them to be.
Okay. Thank you for that, General. Yep. Again, this was a question just trying to find out what the nexus is between demobilization when TriWest, TriCare kind of comes into play, and it does sound as if the issue has been resolved.
Yeah, it was a bad misinterpretation by some lower-level leaders in that organization that caused the biggest part of this, because that wasn't what Congress intended for the six-month TAMP care.
Thank you for that clarification.
Colleagues,
I think that we need to move on. We're a little bit behind, but I expect that I'm going to call Mr. Mann up at this point. I think this is his turn. And any colleagues that he would like to bring forward with him? Oh, I see Mr. Willis is here. And give us some updates on the various task force that we instituted last legislative session. And gentlemen, I'm sure you can get us back on time. So, yeah. Okay. Good morning. Hi, Mr. Willis.
Good morning.
Nice to see you today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm going to very briefly go through how we got to these three task force forces. As you recall, in 2008, there was a governor's task force on veteran services who wrote an exhaustive report with findings and recommendations. Based on those findings and recommendations, we came to the 2009 legislative session, where we had an extraordinary success in serving the veterans and their families of this state. So much so that 25 bills passed, 6 House or Senate joint resolutions, and 3 Senate joint memorials. Many of the messages from those memorials to the United States Congress are still making their way through the legislative process, much to the benefit of not only veterans in our state, but across the nation. Based on also the action of the 2009 session, 3 important bills were passed relating to these task forces. They were Senate Bill 98, which created the Veterans Task Force on Transportation, House Bills 2718, which created the Task Force on Women's Veterans Health Care, and finally Senate Bill 700, which created the Task Force on Reintegration. Today you will hear from representatives from those task forces as to where they are in the process. And I want to say very clearly, because 2 of the members, at least, of these 2 joint committees serve on these task forces. Representative Cowan serving on the Women's Healthcare, Veterans Healthcare Task Force, and Senator Schrader, who serves on the Reintegration Task Force. It's important to note that the people serving on this task force are, for the most part, all volunteers. And when they go on field visits, they do so voluntarily. And I just want to say publicly how much I appreciate their hard work. Representing the Task Force on Veterans Transportation, you will hear a report from Michael Ward, who is chair of that task force. Following Michael's testimony, you will hear from Elon Lambert, who is representing the chair of that committee, who unfortunately is not in the state right now, so I'm positive Elon will do a great job representing the Women's Veterans Healthcare Task Force. And finally, you will hear from the Task Force on Veterans Reintegration. You will hear from Bob Plame. He will be joined by Jack Himes and Scott McCray. And all of them will be assisted by the staff member from my department who staffs all 3 of these task forces, which is Tom Mann. I'm happy to answer any questions. However, in the interest of time, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think we're ready to start with the reports, if you are.
Sounds good.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Chair Schrader, Chair Cowan, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Michael Ward. My day job is the administrator of the Public Transit Division of the Oregon Department of Transportation, but I'm here today with the distinct honor of serving as chair on this transportation task force for our veterans. I also like to apologize if my voice sounds a little scratchy. I'm just getting over some crud, so I may have to pause for a drink. In trying to recognize the urgency and the time constraints here, I'm certainly not going to read my report to you. Suffice to say, we have a great committee. We have members of various state departments, a lot of public transit providers. We have members from our congressional delegation who sit in. We have a great group of folks who really are sincere about how do we solve some of our transportation issues as they relate to our vets. And what you have in front of you is a long list of findings, but what I'd like to do in just a minute or two is just share with you some of the themes of those findings. One of those themes is that the veterans who need our services the most is those that we struggle with providing transportation services to. So we have to find a way to leverage and find transportation systems for veterans wheelchair-bound or in our more rural areas. We have to find a way to do that. Something that I'm sure you'll hear now and in the future is we need to find a stable, sustainable, dedicated funding source for veterans transportation. That does not exist today. And I'm sure one of our recommendations will try to address what that might look like. You'll see in some of the recommendations the issue of coordination. We do need to get better at how do our public transit agencies, our Department of Veterans Affairs, our volunteers through the Disabled American Veterans, and our partners at the federal level, how can we coordinate better in both the financial side and the actual provision of transportation services to our veterans? There's lots of areas where we could do a better job. And I'll take just a moment to give you an example. On the public transit side, we have systems which we call brokerages. They're essentially call centers, coordination efforts, and transportation providers for essentially seniors and folks with disabilities who get reimbursed through a number of human services funding programs. Well, lots of our veterans are seniors and people with disabilities, and they can qualify for these services also, but one of the surprising things we found, and that's why it's a finding here, is that we don't coordinate very well. We don't leverage that infrastructure on the public transportation side to help our veterans, and we need to do a better job about that. There's also an educational piece, just letting folks know, our veterans know, what are the public transportation services already available to them, and how they can take advantage of those services might help us address some of the needs. And the last item I'll share with you, and then open it up for questions, is sort of the last bullet, if you turn the page over, and that is, as we engage in an aggressive outreach program in letting our veterans know the services and the medical services that they're eligible for, and you just heard a presentation about that, they will need more transportation services to avail themselves of those services. So it's one of those, the better job we do of letting our veterans know what services they provide, the more transportation services they're going to need. And but the group, the task force, creative people, we look forward to coming back with a series of recommendations that help address some of these themes. So with that, Chair Schrader and Chair Cowan, I'll leave it for questions.
Well, I would like to make just one comment based on a comment that Chair Cowan made when we were having our TRICARE piece, and that is that you've got these gray areas, okay, large gray areas, and where access seems to be the issue. So in order to make sure that the system, the robust system that seems to be in place in the valley and on the western edge of Oregon is accessible, and I know Representative Stigler did a great job in the Bend area of finding those providers, that seems to be the big issue. So if there is a lack of access in rural areas, it seems to me one of the challenges is how you, as you've said here, how do you align transportation opportunities to make sure that the entitlements that these folks have earned, that they have access to appropriate health care. So striking to me how the health care piece and the transportation piece actually go hand in hand in terms of access issues. So
I would also like to add a comment. Go ahead. Please.
No, I would just respond to Chair Schrader. They are hand in glove. It does no good to provide medical services in Portland if the veteran in John Day or Mitchell can't get there. It just doesn't. So, and that was quickly identified by the task force. We have lots of public transit folks. We have lots of others, and that's a issue we want to tackle and be able to come back with some recommendations on how we think we can solve some of that.
Thank you. And I also have some comments. We're faced with a bit of a dilemma when we ask individuals who are deeply committed to what they're doing to go out and research some of our problem areas, and then we come back with a rather exhaustive list of what our problem areas are, and we say, and how are we going to solve that? So what I wanted to say to you is, first of all, thank you to all of your group, and you may hear the theme I'm about to put out here more than once this morning. But I appreciate the approach that you're taking as well First, we have to know what a problem is before we can solve it. And secondly, we need to look at creativity within what we already have. And I'm really hearing you say that about our transportation programs. What we can do first and foremost is if policy change is needed so that we can better coordinate something, or we have a vehicle that's only used for a limited sort of usage and could be used somewhere else as well if we just had a policy that allowed that, those are absolutely the things that we can take on, particularly in the next regular session. I see one here that mentions surplus vans and federal policy would need to allow it. We can certainly encourage federal policy change as well if those things can help.
I'm glad you picked up on that one.
Oh, I highlighted that immediately, actually. By the way, the third to the last bullet, the counties that have no available transportation, LeGrand is Union County, so yeah. Maybe we should kind of keep it all as to counties versus that. County and city.
Oh.
Sorry, it's an old stomping grounds for me. I can't help myself.
I apologize.
but I think that's what we're looking at. I have been in this committee trying to bring various agencies together and say, how does what we do over here impact what we do over here, and how can we make that work together? So anything that we can see in the greater arena of transportation, what we're doing over here, what we might be doing over here, and how we could mesh those to better serve all of our population and most certainly our veterans would be very much appreciated. So thank you for your work.
And just one comment. I know, Senator Morissette, you have a question as well. I just wanted to make one comment, Representative Cowan, Chair Cowan, that one of the pieces today is to actually do the findings, and then the next substantive piece is, as you just described, what are the policy shifts? And more than likely, given what we are facing in the budget, it's probably going to try and be policy shifts that have the least cost to the overall resources that we have. And that's going to take a lot of creativity, but I think that's where we are.
Madam Chair, for the record, Tom Mann with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Luckily, the federal government just passed the Veterans Caregivers Bill, and in that bill, there are three different rural veteran transportation grant programs, some for very rural, seven people per, I think, mile, and then some other rural transportation. So I think our department is going to avail itself to this grant process once they write the rules. So I think in the recommendations piece, you're going to see us talk a lot about that federal grant process through the Caregivers Bill instead of coming to this body.
So we're primed because of the work that we've done then in order to access other dollars. Great. I'm sorry, Senator Morissette, you've been very patient.
Thank you very much. That partly answers my question, which was, is there a federal entitlement program for transportation for veterans to get to the hospital? Is there?
At this time, no, sir.
No. Okay.
But there is a mileage payback of 44 cents per mile. So if you drive yourself to the hospital, they will reimburse your mileage.
Now that is a federal.
That is a federal through the VA hospitals, but not to the clinics and not to the vet centers. So if you go to Roseburg Hospital, the White City Domiciliary, or the Portland VA Hospital, they'll reimburse.
Okay. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. No other questions? Thank you.
Okay.
Let's see. I know that we have some folks here to talk about the women's health care, and so I think Elan is here, and Mr. Himes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alon Lambert. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Partners in Crisis. I'm here today to provide you an update on the Legislative Task Force on Women Veterans Health Care. The task force has been busy in the last couple months. We visited the White City VA Southern Oregon Rehabilitation Resource Center, as well as the Portland VA Medical Center, where tours of women's clinics, and met with healthcare leaders about how they provide gender-specific care and their plans to focus more attention on women veterans. committee also attended a Women Veterans Forum at the Portland VA Medical Center, during which about 150 women veterans shared their opinions and concerns with the medical center leadership. And then next month we will tour the Roseburg VA hospital to learn about their services to women veterans. The task force is in the beginnings of, or the process of determining its findings. This is a rather long report, which I'll make very short. And I wanted to just focus on a few things and then ask if Mandy and Jack have any catch of things that I missed. I think part of it is that looking at the special issues of women veterans, the gender-specific issues. So part of the challenge is that women veterans and the new women veterans entering the system have complex health care needs from exposure to both combat and military sexual trauma. And the top three healthcare diagnoses for women veterans are post-traumatic stress disorder, hypertension, and depression, two of which of these are mental health issues, which are very important to developing adequate mental health services that are targeted and gender-sensitive for women veterans. PTSD is associated with higher physical and psychological comorbidity with other problems. And one of the things in Oregon is that 20% of Oregon women veterans who use the VA have a mental health diagnosis, 44% of which are Iraq-Afghanistan women veterans. Pretty high number. Women veterans have the highest percentage of mental health and substance abuse disorders than their male counterparts. So part of this is the question of what are the issues for women, the problems that we bring forth, the gender-specific issues that we have, the availability of being able to be treated for our gender-specific issues. And so part of the challenges is availability of care. There's an inadequate number of mental health clinicians to provide psychotherapy, medication management, and case management services to women veterans and that report military sexual trauma. And specifically, there's also a very inadequate number of female mental health clinicians themselves to work with those of us who have military sexual trauma who choose to only work with female providers. Another finding is that the VA has inadequate resources to meet the demands. There are gaps in the providers who are proficient and interested in women's health care. So sufficient staff to service health needs and increasing women veterans will require unprecedented efforts to recruit, train, and support health care professionals. And particularly living in, we were talking about the rural areas, there is a great need also in the rural areas of, for not only for providers, but also for providers, women providers, for working with women specifically. Right now, if you're in a rural area, you have to travel to Portland for specialty care, such as gynecology, surgery, cancer treatment, and orthopedic care. Contracts with local service providers are limited at this time, and this could be an area where a collaboration could be developed. In Oregon, there are also limited acute psychiatric beds available for the most urgent psychiatric crisis stabilization. Both Portland and Roseburg have what are called swing beds on a first-come, first-served basis. There's 12 rehabilitation beds now open for women veterans at White City Domiciliary. However, inpatient treatment for military sexual trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, or gender-specific substance abuse treatment is not available in Oregon or the region. There's currently no inpatient or outpatient treatment program for co-occurring disorders. And treatment for trauma and substance abuse among women veterans is a growing need. Also, part of the availability of care is you have a lot of with the women veterans who have children who there's no place to for them to bring their children and to provide care for the kids while they're going to their appointments. Many of them are employed, and so it's difficult getting time off to attend appointments. There's also really poor or no outreach to women veterans, and a lot of women, one of the issues is that the visibility of women veterans is in a lot of places women veterans are, one, they may not identify themselves as a woman veteran, but two, the awareness in our communities about women serving in the military still needs to be upgraded because most people, a lot of people think when you think about veterans, it's men. And we have had well over 200,000 women in Iraq and Afghanistan theaters. So the issues with women veterans is going to be increasing over the years. While the male population gets older, the women veterans will be the greater needs for services. Let's see, what else?
Madam Chair.
Yes, we have a question, Senator.
Yes.
Is traumatic brain injury an issue with women's veterans, a diagnosis of traumatic brain injury, as opposed to being some other ailment?
Do you
want to... An interesting situation in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Jack Himes, H-E-I-M-S. In Afghanistan and Iraq is that even though women aren't allowed to, quote, be in combat, they clearly are in combat. They're the after the door is broken down there, the translator running into a house, they're gunners on tops of convoys, and they're taking apart bombs, and that's not combat. So they have the same exposure, especially to IEDs, that any male does in those situations. So, yes, that's another component. And like these other disease entities that Alana described, they're just starting to surface. You know, women who had their bell rung, so to speak, are starting to say, oh, maybe my memory issues now are related to that, and they're starting to seek help.
Okay, because that just that's a misdiagnosed condition often with veterans, and particularly, I think, with women, because you wouldn't assume that women are in those situations. But yeah. Thank you.
Colleagues, any other questions? I know we have some other folks up here. Senator Volquist, yes.
Just to follow up to that, to reinforce what Senator Morissette is saying, is my observations, and I work with 115 battalions that deployed either Afghanistan or Iraq. I mean, my anecdotal observation is women are probably in a higher percentage category than men are. And this boils down to the fact that what he was saying is that they're in the support role, and nobody in his right mind attacks a combat infantry company that's fully loaded for bear, which is a fact in all of the engagements, and what is in most of the engagements that are happening, whether it's IEDs and concussions and elements of traumatic stress and brain and all that stuff, are in the support units, which are on a higher percentage of women. So I would say that, you know, women, you know, from a medical perspective, we've got to be looking harder at women because they are more likely to have been in that situation than their male infantry combat arms counterpart.
I would agree with you, sir. My name is Mandy Martin. I'm a veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom and a stakeholder on the Women's Veterans Task Force. I would say that everybody who goes through the VA system currently, especially Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom veterans, are looked at for traumatic brain injury, but it would be very easy to overlook signs and symptoms of traumatic brain injury because of our gender. So, you know, they would could potentially assume that these signs and symptoms could be related to something vastly different. So although they are looking at it and women are being evaluated and treated for traumatic brain injury, it could easily be overlooked.
Thank you for that. Jack, have you had anything else to add at this point in time?
Okay. I would like to just point out one thing, that keeping in mind that female veterans entering the VA system currently is the fastest growing demographic in the VA healthcare system at this time. And so I believe that we as a task force need to really be looking at tools on how we can accommodate this growing population of women veterans, and really, really looking to the future, because we are looking at much, much younger women and much younger veterans entering into our VA healthcare system, and we need to really, really be prepared for that. And what is happening right now needs to be expanded, and it needs to be updated to meet these modern women that are coming into, young and modern women that are coming into the VA healthcare system.
And in addition to that, as an older veteran, as we age, we have other issues that need to be addressed, and so it's putting a burden also on the VA. And I just want to add that the current mental health providers, and specifically military sexual trauma providers, have a large caseload with very complex patients, and that caseload is quite high, and the there's, I think this is an area that is very important, because as we continue along, the issues with women are going to be more and more, and I think that, thank you for taking the time with us.
But I know that Representative Cowan, or Chair Cowan, wants to make one last comment to move us forward, and I'm just going to make one comment also that jumped out at me. Domestic violence with military women is a huge, huge issue, and we have worked with our DAs and looked at some legislation to try and look at that a little bit differently, or very closely with advocacy groups, to make them aware and understand that these are issues with different etymologies than you might see with other chronic abuse kinds of manifestations. The other piece is that when you talk about having a lack of resources, where this lands, I know Representative Cowan will appreciate this, oftentimes it's county service delivery systems. So what happens is that even though folks are entitled to services, if the capacity at the VA level isn't there, it's going somewhere. Mm-hmm. And it's really already going to overburdened counties who are working with nonprofits and other entities trying to play catch-up with this. And sometimes they don't have that other piece of knowledge or connect the dot that, okay, this is related to, you know, potentially military service or things that have happened to folks in military service. And last piece is a question. Now, we are opening the first Women's Veterans Center. Where are we with that? Just for the record, where are we with that?
We just broke down the wall for the okay. entrance into this brand new Women's Veterans Healthcare Clinic located at the Portland VA Medical Center. It was a wonderful event of getting to break down one more barrier for women veterans. They're looking at opening the doors around the August timeframe for women veterans there.
Thank you. Representative Callahan.
Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah.
Again, thank you to those of you who have been serving on this task force. And, Elon, you've been putting a lot of miles all over the state in a variety of roles. I, too, serve on that task force and have found it very interesting, informative, and educational. The list on your report is very daunting when you look at the size of it. But I think that what I want to focus us on is, first of all, there's a great deal of passion in our communities to step forward and to recognize some issues that many of us didn't even know existed. And that's the first step in accomplishing moves forward, is to have some awareness of what the needs are. So this task force is serving, I believe, a very valuable role in helping with that recognition of the need and focusing on the issue of women as soldiers, women who have not self-identified themselves as veterans, who have not felt that they were veterans. They very much are. And that's the first step, is a recognition of their rights, and secondly, of some of the unique challenges that that are gender-specific in this particular situation. I appreciate you mentioning the opening of the new women's medical facility at the Portland VA Med Center. That, I think, that's a very exciting first step. A lot of recognition around the need for female providers, and things that the general public simply have not been aware of. So that's our first goal, is to help with awareness, and then we can move forward in logical, sequential steps in meeting some of those needs. So thank you for your service.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
One more thing. My sister is an 88-year-old veteran who lives in California. She goes to the Palo Alto Center. I don't think she knew about the reimbursement for transportation. I'll check that out. She is currently she has to move out of her existing apartment, which is on the third floor, looking for other affordable housing, and the veterans have a program that will compensate veterans who served during wartime, which she did. Now, what's the definition of wartime? Are we talking Vietnam? Are we talking Korea? What's a war? You ought to look into that and take a look at those elderly women veterans who are in need, which you're doing. I think that's great.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, what I'd like to say is that I believe, and Jackie may know this also, and Mandy too, is that I believe you have to live 50 miles away from the medical center to get reimbursement for the mileage, first of all. Mm-hmm. And yes, I think that there are a number of us on the committee who are older in looking towards the future of what needs to happen for us along the way. So what we're looking at is, as I said in the report, from 19 to 100 years of age. It's not just the returning veteran, women veterans. It's for all services in all times.
And the VA has established what is considered war in each individual conflict. And there are individuals who will be able to help her navigate, you know, what all of the exact things that she is entitled to. So she doesn't have to do it alone.
Thank you so much. I believe we have the third and final report coming up. And I see Colonel McRae here.
I've been trying to help
so? Jack. And colleagues, this is the team I serve on for reintegration, and a little more familiar with some of the findings we've had, but we'd like to share them with you here today. And so, gentlemen, if you get started and introduce yourself, that would be
okay.
Great.
Thank you, Madam Chairs and members of this committee. For the record, my name's Bob Plaim. I'm a member of the Legislative Task Force on Veterans Reintegration Program, and I'm retired Marine Corps and a combat veteran. And on my right, I have Jack Himes, who's on the committee as well, and Colonel Scott McRae. I want to thank you for the invitation to update this committee on the progress of the Legislative Task Force on Reintegration. We've been meeting monthly since last year and have made great progress in our mission from the Senate Bill 700, which is to develop and design continuing regional reintegration programs for our returning veterans. The process we used was similar to what we used on the Governor's Task Force for Veteran Services, where we've identified the stakeholders and participants and asked them or invited them to join us in coming up with solutions from their experiences. To date, the task force has had briefings on Oregon Yellow Ribbon's reintegration team, WorkSource Oregon, needs of the 41st Infantry Combat Brigade team that just returned from Iraq, veterans' employment issues, the National Emergency Grant that will be used to help the 41st transition, and others. In previous meetings, the task force outlined what services constitutes reintegration, as well as identifying partners who can help with that reintegration. Some of the services we looked at were the employment services, educational licensing services, family services to include domestic violence, financial security, and suicide prevention. The judiciary, criminal justice services, housing services, health care, mental health care services. And our partners that were involved were local governments, service organizations, county veterans, service officers, armories, local employment veterans representatives, disabled veterans outreach programs, and colleges, universities, as well as the healthcare, VA healthcare system, the VA benefit system, the National Veteran Service Organizations, nonprofit organizations, faith-based organizations, County Mental Health, Oregon Military Department, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and state agencies that interact with our returning veterans. As you can see, a lot of people were involved. During our last meeting on May 17th, the task force began the process of enumerating the findings. This process involved determining what the issues are that will need to be addressed by the task force and its recommendations. And the following are our findings. The transition bridge funding right now is insignificant to help veterans transition between unemployment and work. And I believe right now the veterans returning, 50% are unemployed. 50%. Military skills are not routinely cross-checked for college credits right now. We also find that currently there is no regional or central coordinating authority for reintegration efforts. This is a big issue. Current funding for the Fort Oregon, which is the website for the returning veterans to go to, is limited to 1 year. The website will need continuing funding. We also found that the military culture discourages troops from self-identifying medical, emotional, and psychological and other reintegration issues. This has got to change. And the current services for reintegration veterans are significant during the first 6 months in most areas, but not every veteran is eligible for all the services. There appears to be three distinct 12-month periods that a veteran goes through after they return from deployment, and services are needed for each phase. We also found, it also appears that veterans begin to have significant crisis at the 18 to 24-month time frame. There also needs to be a smooth handoff of reintegrating veterans from the military to the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. We find that providing reintegration services to active duty and reserve veterans is difficult if they do not self-identify, and that's been a very big issue for us. Some National Guard and Reserve veterans are being redeployed within the reintegration time period, and they're not healed or all our issues are not solved by the time of that redeployment. Returning soldiers are being told by some active duty elements that the VA will take care of them instead of being taken care of by the military. Soldiers on terminal leave cannot use the VA, and TRICARE is difficult to access in some regions of our state. The VA healthcare system right now is being overwhelmed by the large demobilization that's taken place and of those veterans applying for VA healthcare. We found that families are also essential in this reintegration of soldiers, and services for families post-deployment are lacking right now. Unemployment for Oregon returning veterans is exponentially higher than the national average, again running around 50%. We found that women's veterans may experience different reintegration issues than their male counterparts, and is not being fully addressed at this time. Marketing public relations are another important component of the reintegration delivery system that we're looking at. Right now, the military takes about 6 months to train a soldier for combat, but only 5 days to return him back to civilian life. This is unacceptable. An integrated and coordinated reintegration program will require some funding and coordination. Upon release from Title 10 orders, a National Guard or Reserve service member is eligible for continued TRICARE coverage for a period of time based on the length of their active duty service. However, the service member must sign up for this continuing coverage. Some service members may not properly navigate this application process, and they and their family members may lose that continued coverage. The Oregon Department of Veterans Campus Veterans Service Office program has been extremely successful, and it needs to be continued on to outreach to students for their benefits. Right now, there are no individual caseworkers following veterans through this 36-month reintegration process. Although the VA healthcare system has just implemented a new system to help provide services to the 41st infantry combat brigades. So right now, these are the findings that we've come up with. And the next step for the task force will be to determine recommendations for these findings and then prioritize them, find action, including writing state and federal legislation, enhancing policies, or simply creating new partnerships to meet the goals of the task force. We're confident that the regional reintegration system can be established in Oregon. It will take coordination, direction, and leadership. We are determined to provide our returning veterans as much support as they need during the first 36 months after returning home. Right now, if we have any questions, we'd be happy to answer that. There's a lot we went through.
Colleagues, any questions at this point? Colonel McRae, did you want to add something right now?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Colonel McRae, as you know, we have been working reintegration on the National Guard side for approximately the last 5 years. Some of the successes, I'd want to point out some of the successes and some of the challenges that we still face. The successes have really been the partnerships with state and civilian agencies throughout Oregon. Everybody we have asked for help for has stepped up. Obviously, or arguably, we have the best reintegration program in the National Guard throughout the United States. And I'll argue that with anybody, and then we can go have a beer afterwards.
I'll buy.
Okay.
We have briefed somewhere in the neighborhood of 15,000 National Guard and Reserve soldiers, and the Reserve includes U.S. Army Reserve, Navy Reserve, Marine Corps Reserve, and Coast Guard. So we're very active across the spectrum and are not just limited to the National Guard. We have a toll-free helpline that we established when we first stood it up. We are using now changing to the Fort Oregon website. The Fort Oregon website will now take you into what was our reintegration website with significant enhancements that will come as we pursue the contract with a new website that has a lot more information that will be applicable to anybody in the service and to retired as a single point of entry, and it will be cooperative throughout the state. The statewide summit, we've done 10 semi-annual statewide summits, starting out with an audience of 20 who didn't know each other and didn't like each other, to now we normally have from somewhere around 250 that participate. Mm-hmm. Our next statewide summit is on the 14th of October at the Anderson Readiness Center, and of course you are all invited to participate. We encourage you to participate because it is a statewide awareness issue. The jobs program, we have helped approximately 650 of our National Guard soldiers get jobs. Our plan right now with the return of the 41st is to get that somewhere within the next year to around 1,400 that get jobs, more than double what we've done in the last 5 years, just because of the unemployment of 50% that somewhere around 1,200 that return that do not have jobs. One of the initiatives that we're working right now with a private entity in Oregon, Software Association of Oregon, on the 4th of June at the Portland Air Base, we have invited 300 to 500 of the largest employers in the state of Oregon. We're working through the Chambers of Commerce and the private industry to invite key employers, CEOs, and vice presidents of operations, so that we're going to have Senator Wyden, Senator Merkley, Governor Kulongoski, General Reese will address these employers and pour on them the necessity to be able to assist our National Guardsmen and women and all military with support from the civilian side in jobs.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator
Preference points Do veterans get preference points, and how does that work?
Veterans do get preference points. I'll defer to Tom Mann with the Department of Veterans Affairs, because they're different on the federal and the state side.
Okay.
But and I believe you can correct me if right on the civilian side, there are no preference points on the civilian side. There is a bill to provide better tax offset for employers, and this will come because I believe Senator Merkley has been instrumental in it on what is happening at the federal level. So, so anyway, the TRICARE, we worked very closely. We really have a better coverage in Oregon for TRICARE, and you can see by the map than most any state. In the United States, but that's not good enough, and we're continuing to work that. We did another first with the 41st Brigade when they returned back through Joint Base Lewis-McChord. Rolls off your tongue, doesn't it? Fort Lewis always sounded better. But at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, we took a team up there with Jim Booker and the Employment Division with their local veterans employment representatives, and we had from 3 to 4 veterans employment representatives at JBLM, short for Joint Base Lewis-McChord, for the entire demobilization period of the 41st, the entire 3 weeks. And we were our specific target were the 1,200 unemployed guardsmen and women from the 41st that came back through. We have no illusions that we were going to get anybody a job when they left. But it was to educate them on what their benefits were, what kind of assistance we had to offer, and what we had upcoming with job fairs this summer, as well as what is available out there. So we did one-on-one time with them during their downtime in their barracks and stuff. And we had approximately 900 of the soldiers come through and talk to our employment representatives, which is a first. We've never done it before. I don't know that anybody else ever has. We also had education rep up there and representatives. And we had approximately, surprised us, there were 230 that were going to school, secondary education, prior to deployment. So we were expecting to talk and reach out and touch about 200 of them. We actually ended up counseling one-on-one, eyeball to eyeball, approximately 700 soldiers. One of the things is the post 9/11 GI Bill is a great deal. It pays for school, pays for everything. But there's also training unemployment insurance that they can draw for 2 years while they go to school. So some of these that are unemployed went from unemployed to now going to school. They actually transferred over because of the benefits that are available for school. So that was a real plus. Challenges, Oregon has now created a J-9 section. I'm the J-9. Under this J-9, we have put the joint services, joint support services, and that will include the reintegration family program, our warrior transition unit that keeps track of the wounded soldiers that are still on active duty. We have the defense enrollment eligibility reporting system, a long word for the ID card system, DEER system that we have. And then TriWest Service Center and TriWest is basically under my umbrella, and we do direct coordination with the employer support of the Guard and Reserve. So we have consolidated a lot of those that were individual entities under one umbrella to better manage the time and resources. Challenges and future needs. Current trends indicate, and who you talk to, 20% plus or minus post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's the incident rate, and there's a growing number of the diagnosed with traumatic brain injury, and the local trend of nearly 50% unemployed on return. So our education and the education of military community on a variety of these issues, including the rights and benefits, programs available, getting the community, the local community involved, and always we have the needs for better and simpler communications. Part of that, Fort Oregon, we hope to make it part of the communication system and be able to have as an entry portal rather than a bunch of that are out there. needs redeployment. We talked about the redeployment through Fort Lewis or through JBLM. The National Guard does not really have a seat at the table, nor does the reserve component a seat at the table when we do deployments and redeployments. We have to beg our way in the door to try to get anything that we want in addition to what that redeployment site has, and each site is different. Fort Lewis, JBLM, is different from Fort Carson, Colorado, is different from Fort Stewart, Georgia. We talk about commonality across there. They might be similar, but they are definitely different. We need to be at the table when we do mobilizations and demobilizations, we being the National Guard and Reserve component, so that we have an input. The education piece that we did for our soldiers, we did in downtime, was not part of the formal program. The employment piece we did was during downtime, not part of the formal program. We have unique needs. We need those unique needs incorporated into the redeployment cycle. And then the soft landing, more time to be able to touch them, and the soft landing that that has been proposed by Senator Wyden and Congressman DeFazio. And the last, or one of the last, the federal funding for the ID cards, the federal government puts ID card machines out there, the Coast Guard site in Coos Bay, at different locations. They give the machine, but they have no manpower resource that comes with it. So what it becomes is an additional duty. I believe the Coast Guard site at Coos Bay, you can correct, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but they were open like 2 hours a week to do ID cards. Well, how is that going to service our needs? And the ID cards is the entry portal into the healthcare system, TRICARE, getting on post, getting your retiree benefits, the whole piece. And that right now, we are taking 8 full-time positions out of our funding from the Oregon National Guard to support different sites at locations throughout the state of Oregon. So it needs to be a push up to the federal side for funding for these positions. So, pending your questions, that concludes my short recap.
Yep. And colleagues, any questions or comments at this point in time?
I have a comment when they're completely done, but.
Are we completely done, gentlemen? No other comments? Mr. Himes, you?
Just a quick comment, Jack Himes. I think you're getting a sense of the complexity of veterans' issues for the veterans and their families. And Oregon has been blessed with a huge scope of services to meet those needs. But it's a little of the left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing.
Right.
Senator Atkinson may have services in his district that are desperately needed by a veteran in Senator Schrader's district, and the services don't know they exist. And despite the huge success of the state summit and the success of local, what we're calling vet nets, like in Eugene, Tigard, Salem, it's not enough because there's no communication. And the Fort Oregon website will facilitate that. But a lot of our recommendations will talk about getting a system of communications from very local areas to regional areas to the state level. And you'll see those recommendations when we forward those to you.
Okay, Senator Boker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, first off, I'd like to thank the committee members and the chairs that have been involved since the 05 session. In helping with joint reintegration. But I think the real thanks goes to the people in the audience, Scott McRae, all you folks out there that have made Oregon have, frankly, the only successful reintegration program in the nation. I'm a reserve officer, still am. I work with at least a dozen states. Some of them have absolutely nothing. Having said that, though, I kind of want to bring something to the committee members' attention. The issues that are raised that you've seen in several of these reports, from no say on where you get deployed, how you get redeployed, Joint Base Fort Lewis, which is not joint, you can throw that in the trash can and stomp on it with both feet. The Guard or the Reserve component are not welcome to be part of the formal demob process. Soldiers told they have to go to VA. If you go back to 2005, and several members here were in the 05 committees that were then, these are problems we had there that we got resolved. And we got those resolved, frankly, in my personal opinion. I'll say that because I always already faced retribution earlier this morning, which is why I'm late. When the military decided they needed the reserve components in the National Guard, they stood up and they answered to the good congressmen and women and the member senators and so on and so forth, and we got programs, we got funding, and we got things going in reintegration. All these issues that are now coming back up in late 09 and 11 were there in the beginning. When they wanted us, they fixed them, and now we're at the opposite end. Nothing has changed in 10 years. None of these are new problems. The bottom line is the federal military doesn't need the National Guard and the Army Reserve. I can only speak for those two components. And so these issues that are coming up have been resolved. The General Officer Corps and the civilian oversight at the Department of Defense knows they exist. They know they should be doing it, and they have 100 things to be done and 75 of them funded, and we are falling under the carpet. And unfortunately, it will take a lot of effort to get spotted issues from people's spouses and friends and former speakers of the House to get things done, but it's going to dissipate. And in 2011, when we go into session, this list is unfortunately, in my opinion, going to be larger, not smaller, because of a lack of cooperation from the Department of Defense.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Who's in charge of building the website?
Outside vendor.
Madam Chair, Colonel McRae, the website right now as it starts out will come under me. I'm the point of blame.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that could be the point of solving problems too.
And I might add, we're going to do it in close conjunction with the ODVA, and as we go through the rest of the reintegration task force piece here, how best to use the site across the state of Oregon for entry for all military members and veterans.
We have purchased a software that's in use in other states and has been very successful. And in some ways it's 80% built, because the information about PTSD or Parkinson's and TBI, et cetera, are all built into it. So it's just regionalizing the information. Is the big step, and getting and the marketing piece of letting every veteran and veteran family member know of its existence.
Good. Okay, folks, I'm going to do a time check here, a process check, because we are over time, and we have two more folks to speak. And one of them, I think both actually have come from very long way. So I'm going to have to try and manage our time because we have a whole other section. I want to just say thank you to all of you gentlemen. I had the privilege of serving with you on this committee. Colonel McRae, you are the go-to guy. Jack, you're great. And it's been a wonderful experience. And thank you all for your hard work. And it's been a privilege. So,
thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
As we're in transition on the agenda, can I make a quick comment?
Absolutely.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to, I don't see Director Willis here, but I would like to publicly thank him and or the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs for winning a case for a veteran in Central Point that was a far-flung deal, and a veteran was hung out all on his own and didn't know the process. And our guys won the case. And I just want to say thank you very much. I also want to say thank you, as we're in transition, Madam Chair, to General Caldwell. Mm-hmm. General Caldwell was, and I don't know if this was said before I got here, but went out of his way to make sure that Representative Freeman, Representative Escobar, and I were all welcome to attend the welcoming home of our troops.
Absolutely.
And it was wonderful. And I'll tell you a quick aside, very quick. I asked if it would be okay if my 7-year-old attended. And so on the given day, I put on the senator outfit and shaved. And my son put on his cleanest jeans and his cleanest boots and his nicest press shirt. And he went up to his room all on his own. And he went in his coin jar and he got a quarter and 2 nickels. And he says, "Dad, I'm going to give it to an Army man and say thank you." Now, that was all on his own. And I was pretty proud with 35 cents. So we were backstage with General Caldwell and General Reese and senators and governor and the whole deal. And my son walked in, and he said, "There's my friend, the governor." That's how he refers to the governor. He walked over to the governor, and he said, "Nice to see you, governor." And he reached in his pocket, and he gave the governor the money he was going to gift to a soldier. And the governor was very gracious and took it. And then he winked at me, and he said, "It looks like you're raising a Democrat." I said, "How so?" He says, "Well, he's given money back to the government." So anyway, thank you very much, Mr. Caldwell.
Thank you. You see, even though we're partisan, we're gently partisan and love one another. I'm going to tell that story, Jason. Well, folks, we are going to have to move quickly. The issue we're facing is we have some folks who came from far out of town. I don't want to rush them, but I'm going to make a statement that we do have to move along. We have Stacey Bannerman coming up, who is a military spouse, and she's brought a friend with her. And then after that, we have Jason Leon. Jason served in Iraq, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about what reintegration has been like and about. Stacey has come up all the way from Southern Oregon. Thank you, Stacey. I don't want to rush you, but I'm going to ask you as my friend and as someone who we're working on military family issues to help us be cognizant of our time as we move forward. Yeah. So, okay. All right.
Certainly.
So we'll talk fast and ask questions, folks. Yeah.
I will offer my apologies. I'm the one that's here pushing good senator, because my committee has a dual charge, and we are never getting to our second half of our charge in our meeting, so I am trying very hard to get to it today. Thank you.
Okay, Jean is my good friend.
Fantastic. Thank you, Chairwoman Schrader. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and thank you also, committee members. Again, my name is Stacey Bannerman. I am the active duty Blue Star wife of a 2-time Iraq War veteran. He is currently at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. With me is Sabina Moriarty. She is a 9-year Marine Corps veteran, and she is also the spouse of one of our recently returned Army National Guard soldiers with the 41st Brigade. We will try to expedite things, but given the fact that we are presenting what I believe to be the first ever proposal for a state military family advisory council, I would also ask for your forbearance as we discuss these issues. And we're getting the PowerPoint booted up now, I believe. And as that is happening, I just want to talk a little bit, give you a sense, my experience. I have been a volunteer advocate for our veterans and military family members, particularly what I consider the forgotten populations. And within that, I'm speaking here specifically of the National Guard and Reserve troops. My husband is Army National Guard. Combat Infantry Badge recipient and Bronze Star recipient, among other things. And I also consider women veterans to be one of our forgotten populations, which is why I am pleased to say that I was able to provide the first ever gender-specific retreat for women veterans in the United States of America. I did that right here in Southern Oregon, Representative Esquivel's district, and provided that for our women veterans. We also provide with a sanctuary for veterans and families, Camp Howdy for military kids. And the camp that we provided at the end of March was, in fact, the first peer support recreational weekend specifically for the children of deployed National Guard soldiers that those kids had had since their parents had left. And it was a wonderful weekend, and we're hoping to be able to secure the funding to be able to provide these much-needed programs to our veterans and our military family members. There we go. All right, great. Thank you. So I'm here today to deliver a proposal for the Military Family Advisory Council. And all right, I thought that I had. All right. Here we go. All right. A little bit about my background. I've already touched on that. I do have about 20 years of executive leadership in the nonprofit sector. And I'm the author of the book, When the War Came Home, The Inside Story of Reservists and the Families They Leave Behind. I have provided congressional testimony on Capitol Hill numerous times and recently returned from the first ever military spouse summit in Washington, D.C. at the invitation of the Congressional Military Family Caucus. I have, over the course of my years of volunteer advocacy, had the opportunity to develop a very good relationship with Mrs. Sheila Casey, the wife of the Army Chief of Staff, General George Casey, and she clearly shares my concern regarding our support and services for military families when she said that our military families, after 9-plus years of war, are stretched and stressed to the breaking point. This is a photo taken from the return down in southern Oregon of the 41st Brigade. Our military families were on the front lines here at home. Never before in the history of the United States of America have so many troops who were married with children been serving such lengthy, repeat deployments. We have never before asked so much of our soldiers, and particularly our Guard and Reserve soldiers and our military families. And I want to recognize the outstanding work and effort and support of the Oregon military, of the Oregon National Guard, and the Yellow Ribbon Reintegration Team. We are here because we want to add another tool to that toolbox. Our military families are the first line of support for our troops. We are the primary unpaid caregivers of our veterans. Our citizen soldiers are more likely to be married than active duty troops. Nearly 75% of them are parents. For a variety of reasons, National Guard spouses stress issues, mental health issues during these deployments and after deployments are higher than those of active duty spouses. Military families' mental health needs are largely unmet. According to the largest study ever done on the emotional impact of war on Army lives, and this came out just a few months ago, the spouses of soldiers sent to combat suffer significantly higher rates of mental health issues than the spouses of the soldiers who remain stationed here in the United States. The deployment-related mental health issues among our military kids have skyrocketed. And every time we surge in Iraq or Afghanistan, our mental health issues, our kids' use of mental health surges right along with it. Deployment-related mental health issues of National Guard and Reserve children are even higher than those of active duty kids. And I can assure you our families are deeply concerned about that because we have got a whole generation of military children who are suffering and oftentimes in silence. We are here to speak for them. Since 2003, inpatient visits among military children have increased 50%. There is a severe shortage of mental health care facilities, and this is on post. For those of us who are living in rural areas or with the National Guard, it's extremely difficult to find mental health care resources, and you can pretty much forget about finding any help that from a provider who is really familiar with the realities and impacts of these deployments and what it's like to be the family left behind.
Stacy,
mm-hmm.
May I just interrupt you for a moment here? We are under a time constraint. What you are telling us this morning right now,
mm-hmm.
I would actually respectfully say the committee, we are aware of it, mm-hmm. of a lot of the things you're describing, and you have a PowerPoint that we have in our possession
mm-hmm.
that you're going through. I'm going to make a suggestion, and I'm going to apologize to you because you came a very long way, and I want to hear you and your friend.
All right.
Can I suggest, because we're trying to combine two committees, since we have a PowerPoint and we have an opportunity to review that, and a lot of what we've talked about this morning is really reflected in your PowerPoint. Can we get to what the kernel is of what your concept is for Military Family Advisory Council? With the understanding, my dear, that we have this, we're reading it, and we have spent a lot this morning with the knowledge of what you're describing to us with our military families and what they're dealing with and suffering. So thank you for helping us move along. So can we get to that point? So
you're welcome in advance.
Okay,
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
If we could take 5 minutes, please, to hear from Sabina Moriarty. I think she's got a very unique perspective.
Great.
And then I'll get directly to the meat of what the Military Family Advisory Council is about.
Thank you. And I do appreciate that because you did come. Colleagues, Stacey drove all the way up from Medford today with her friend. It's a 5-hour drive. So I don't want to put us where we're cutting people off, but we need to get to the meat. So let's move on with Sabina.
Okay. Sabina.
I apologize. I'm sorry. Sabina.
This is the first time I've done this. Am I close enough to the...
And give your name and where you're from. Okay.
My name is Sabina Moriarty, and I live in Ashland, Oregon right now. So, good morning. My name is Sabina Moriarty. Thank you for the honor and opportunity to speak to you today as a military family member in Oregon. I'm very happily married to one of your proud National Guardsmen, Corporal Stephen A. Moriarty, who deployed this past year to Iraq with the 41st Infantry Brigade. Stephen and I are the parents of 8 children, and they range in age from our oldest daughter, who is 17, to our brand new son, who is only 7 weeks old. I am also an honorably discharged military veteran, having had the pleasure and the distinct honor of serving my country on active duty as a United States Marine for 9 years. This puts me in a unique position to be able to speak to you today, as I have experienced being on both sides of the military fence. The deployed service member at war and the home spouse of a deployed service member. I wish I could sit here before you today and tell you that having been in my husband's shoes as a deployed service member, a deployed Marine, that this made my personal experience with Stephen's first deployment easier in some way, but I can't. Being the family member of a deployed service member is far, far more difficult than being the one deployed. As a deployed service member, I had the opportunity to bond and share experiences, good and bad, with my fellow Marines. The experience for the families left at home, as I found out, and especially for National Guard spouses and families, is extremely different, especially so for the spouses and families of service members here in Oregon, where the service members are attached to, activated, and deployed with National Guard units, reserve units, and so on. As a family member, you are nearly invisible. The fact that your husband, your wife, your father, your mother is in a war zone and in constant danger has seemed to fade into just background noise for most people. Worried about how my children would cope with their father's deployment, I asked the principal of my children's elementary school, how many of your children at this school have military family members that will deploy soon? Do you have a plan on how to handle how they will be helped to cope here at school? Not only did she have no idea, she didn't give it a second thought. Never returned phone calls. None of the schools my children attended had any idea of how many children in their attendance would be affected, nor did they have a solid plan on how to help them cope. We can do better, Oregon, in this one area alone. I have lived in Oregon for only 4 years, and I was left to navigate my new supporting role to my service member this past deployment without a solid network of friends, no family in the area, and minimal support from an ever-changing family readiness group representatives who more often than not came into their positions untrained and unsupported by their own infrastructure. My personal experience here at home was a mixed bag of the daily frustrations, utter exhaustion, overwhelm, loneliness, fear, anger, stress, and confusion bordering on insanity. I did experience and deal with the normal situations that spouses face on deployment, such as taking on all aspects of the child rearing, bill paying, shopping, maintaining the household, the yard work, driving children to their seemingly endless appointments, after school activities, and weekend games. I learned how to fix household appliances and even some very basic auto maintenance fixes. And up until this past October, I was also a full-time student in the pursuit of my bachelor's degree in business administration. I also dealt with other stressful issues, such as having to put off the completion of my bachelor's degree with less than 1 year left to complete. I forfeited the remainder of my Montgomery GI Bill monies because I'm a pre-post 9/11 veteran.
You're doing fine. You're doing great.
The remainder of my Montgomery GI Bill monies that I was using to complete my education up to a 10-year cap on its dissemination. I survived a high-risk pregnancy with gestational diabetes, an unexpected financial crisis that nearly brought us to being homeless during the holiday season. As much as I had anticipated it, planned for it, sought out professional help for it, and spent many, many sleepless nights trying to fix it, I saw each and every one of my children have extreme behavioral changes related directly to the deployment of their father, ranging from just plain acting badly and acting out to two suicide scares by one of my children. Excuse me.
Take your time.
I can honestly say without a doubt that this is the most difficult year of my life. Thank you. I always knew that the spouses and families of deployed service members sacrificed much to support their husbands or wives that were deployed. However, until I experienced it myself, I did not have a clear, complete understanding of how much a sacrifice that actually is. With the realization that family members who stay at home far outnumber the service members deployed, one of the things that struck me the most was that there is not enough support for the families here at home. It will eventually directly affect successful mission accomplishment by the service members, and in the end, this will put our service members' lives at stake. This is something that is not only foreseeable, it is absolutely preventable. The other day, I was in a restaurant with my husband in his camouflage uniform, and no less than 10 different people came up to him, shook his hand, thanked him for his service, and engaged him in conversation. He was even presented with gift cards to the restaurant by some of the patrons, and we were also given his meal complimentary of the restaurant, all in honor of his service to his country. It struck me then that the military families are nearly invisible, but are in dire need of the same support, the same encouragement, the same thank you that the service members deserve, not because they need the same accolades, but because the support and encouragement of the families directly relate to the support and encouragement of the service member. This is a simplified issue, or excuse me, example, but my point is this. I believe that we can do better, Oregon. I believe we can lead the way as a state on how best to support military families. I would like to encourage your support in the creation, development, and implementation of a desperately needed military family advisory council so that when our troops are deployed, they can be assured that their communities, their townships, and their state are doing the very best supporting and protecting their families while they are away, supporting and fighting for our country. The protection of our nation is necessary, important, and is ever-evolving. The support that we give our troops is solid and well-deserved. Why should the families left behind deserve any less? Once again, I would like to thank you for your time today.
And I would just like to thank you so much for your testimony. Obviously, it is very difficult for you, and I really want to thank you for coming with Stacy. To at least present a concept today. And I think that this committee is hearing you and we have compassion for you. And I believe that there are folks in the audience after the testimony we've heard this morning that are very committed to working with military families. And I'm going to ask my friend Stacy a favor. What we really want to hear from you in a really encapsulated form is what your concept is. Again, this is not because we want to rush through anything as much as it, we are with this because of budget restraints, we're combining two committees, and so that's kind of the time frame we're under. Can you give us succinctly, Stacy, what your idea is and what
military family advisory council? Yes, Senator.
Okay, okay, thank you, my friend.
Yes, Oregon has long supported the need for veterans committees, commissions, task forces, etc. We've heard from some of them today. It is far long past time, frankly, that we leverage the expertise of our military families to inform program policy and oversight processes pertaining to the Oregon military and Veterans Affairs. This also is a way to formally recognize our service and sacrifice as well. This vehicle would provide outreach, open dialogue, and development of shared strategies for military family program support and services. A military family advisory council would help to educate legislators and inform policy decisions that impact our military families. It would provide the governor, legislators, the DVA, Director of Health and Human Services, et cetera, with recommendations and advice on current and future issues. Essentially, this is the ground truth reality, and there may be possibly an inherent conflict of interest in exclusively relying on the individuals at the top and not hearing the real what the reality on the ground. Military Family Advisory Council addresses that and fills that gap. We can recommend media and informational strategies to do outreach, public education, dissemination of new and altered policies such as the Military Family Leave Act of 2009 that Representative Esquivel introduced, would provide advocacy support. We can make available a panel of military family members to provide informed testimony, to involve our military family members in public education to close that gap that's massive between the military and civilian communities. We can review and evaluate key proposals, serve as both a resource, a sounding board, and maybe a little bit of a watchdog. We can conduct town hall meetings in communities. Again, the Task Force for Veterans is doing this. Prepare briefings, policy papers. Convene and participate in conferences and summits. This is happening for our veterans. We need this for our families, and it needs to be a stand-alone endeavor. Modeled after veterans advisory boards and commissions, this nonpartisan council will be comprised of a group of credible and diverse Oregon residents with direct connections to the armed forces, active duty, guard, reserve, and veterans. Okay? We're all active duty veterans, spouses, and families now. Council members drawn from a variety of military families, perspectives, and experiences, including an adolescent. I'm not going to go over the concluding remarks. Policies and programs should provide solid support for families who are struggling with the churn of deployment and the challenges of military life. There is a huge lag between the time that a returning veteran begins to manifest issues and problems and the time that he gets himself into community service. Who is waging that battle? At home, who's dealing with that at home? Because what you all see with our veterans in public, that's the game face. And what we get at home is a whole different kind of deal. We need help and we need support and we need a voice. Many issues such as education and custody and other things really need to be addressed here at the state level. And as I'm sure you know, the Obama administration and the First Lady have expressed a strong commitment to supporting military families and is looking at a White House panel. This, in my conversations with the folks at the White House and in D.C. and Mrs. Casey, this pilot project here in Oregon State or possibly the Pacific Northwest can really be a model, I think, given the dual state and federal status of the Guard. We're uniquely situated. You know, Oregon has really emerged as a national beacon in terms of Guard support and Yellow Ribbon reintegration programming and veterans services by establishing the first Military Family Advisory Council in the country. Oregon State can once again lead the way. Please do so. Thank you.
Thank you for colleagues. Any questions before we wrap up? Yes.
I just have one suggestion. Maybe you might try NCSL, the National Conference of the State Legislatures. They're like all the states are involved, and it's a national group. And I'm pretty sure they have, they address all the issues we all deal with. And I'm pretty sure they would have Veterans Affairs, and that might fit into the. And then you have the audience of the delegations from each state who go to this conference, and they often. I'm not active in it anymore. I've gone to a couple of the big ones, but I know they meet in their other areas within them other times of the year. So I think that our chief clerk of the House, Ramona Kennedy, is deeply involved in this group, and It's NCSL, mm-hmm. National Conference for State Legislatures. I just think that this would be a really great thing for them to address.
Thank you. I appreciate the suggestion. However, we're doing this as volunteers, so of course we're always running up against cost issues because we pay for everything out of pocket and all of our time and energy. And really that's, I think, one of the critical issues. First of all, our military families need to be recognized and identified as a separate entity worthy of support for our unique service. And fundamentally, this is true for us at every single level. We fund what we value.
Okay. I want to thank you. Yes, Senator Volquist.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just want to take a second to thank Sabina and Stacy, and in fact, every wife and every spouse who has had to put up and sacrifice for the deployment of their soldiers, their sailors, and their Marines. And I think probably speak for the entire committee that we understand the sacrifice.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it was very important for you to be here today. And I know my colleagues have all of the information. Your testimony is so moving and heartfelt. So thank you for coming. And I know that with everything we're doing, I think that this is an interesting concept. Again, I do apologize. We couldn't go through the entire PowerPoint, but my colleagues have the copy. We know where to, frankly, to find you. I think it's an intriguing concept, and I want to thank you for your time, and thank you for knowing that we have to, we're trying to pack a lot in, and appreciate the drive you folks took to get here this morning. So thank you so much. And
Madam Chair, excuse me for interrupting you, but before you leave, and thank you, Sabina, too, for your story.
You're welcome.
It made me cry. I don't understand it because haven't experienced it, but I do feel deep compassion for all of you. But could you send it by email maybe
That'd
to our
great.
Staff?
Stacy, could you?
Because it's so small, I can't
send
see
yours,
it even with
the PowerPoint.
Glasses.
Oh, for sure. Yes.
The committee. Yeah. Okay.
Then I can blow it
you
up.
You can get it to our committee
yes.
staff
and then,
person.
Yes,
she'll
absolutely.
Get it out to us. That'd be great.
Can't. Mm-hmm. My older colleagues also can't see without glasses.
We want to thank you. We do have one last guest here today, and I hope that you stay for the rest of the committee, or at least as we move
okay.
to close the veterans piece. And I want to thank Chair Cowan for being very patient with Chairwoman Schrader this morning. You are a dear friend, and thank you. It's close.
We
are going to run out of, we do have a veteran here this morning, Jason Leon. Jason, would you mind coming up and talking about your experiences in Iraq? We'd be nice to get you together with Stacy and Sabina at some point. So.
You can get together for lunch.
Yeah, that might be a good idea.
Madam Chairman,
representatives and senators, I was asked just to share a little bit of my personal testimony this morning. Quite frankly, I'd just assume skip over it, but I'll go ahead and go through with it anyways. I was deployed with Alpha Company, one of the 184 out of California. I was actually with HHC, the snipers, down in 2 of the 162 in Cottage Grove. We were in Baghdad, Iraq from 2004 to about 2006. Our main missions were we would receive intelligence from Iraqis, and we would go in looking for bad guys, basically. And also we'd look for weapon deposits and clear roads of IEDs. We definitely saw our fair share of combat, death. I had a couple of close friends that I lost there. Coming home was definitely the most difficult part of the whole experience because I was in Kuwait and we were heading home from the whole experience, and I received an email from my family telling me that my baby cousin, Caden Ritchie, had just been murdered. And this was the youngest member of my family. And to me, family was huge over there. It was a big part of my purpose. So I told my commander, and he actually flew me home early so that I could be at the funeral. So I sped up through all the demobilization process and was arrived back home January 2006, 15th, which was my birthday, and I was carrying the casket for my baby cousin. First time I'd seen my family in a long time, so it was pretty tough. But through it all, I'm actually, right now, I'm doing really, really well.
public speaking, semi-professionally. We'll see how far that goes. Getting married in August. Family's doing well. I take good care of myself. As I look across all of my buddies in Los Angeles and in Oregon, the common denominator that I see, I have only a few that are doing really good. In fact, two only come to mind. One in California and one in Cottage Grove, who's actually still in the military. He's a sniper. And the common denominator I see of the men that are doing well is purpose. The guys that have a purpose are doing exceedingly well. And the guys that don't have purpose struggle with life. That's all I have. Any questions?
When you say purpose, one of the things we keep hearing is that when folks are coming back, again, the joblessness. Have you experienced that? Is that something?
No, actually, I have quite a few job opportunities.
Really
good. Turning them down.
Great.
Yeah.
But that's something we keep hearing as a committee, that a 51% unemployment rate.
Yeah.
And you seem to be really focused and able to do that. Have you got any suggestions for this committee about the folks that aren't doing well and how do we get them hooked up with employment?
My personal opinion is that it's the individual's responsibility. In other words, it's the individual soldier's responsibility to develop himself to the degree that he's an asset to a company. And so if you have soldiers that are coming back from war and don't feel like they have a deep purpose, they're not that motivated to go out and get a job.
Okay. Colleagues, any questions?
Just congratulations on your upcoming
Thank
wedding.
Yeah.
It's a perfect month to get married.
It'll be good. I'm excited.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I think that is a profound message that needs to be carried into the segments of our society that are underprivileged, who grow up in fractured families, who grow up without a purpose, unless someone comes along and says, hey, if you join my gang. Purpose is all important, and if they have a purpose,
absolutely.
And so I think you've got a great message there and are in a position to share that with people who need it. So
thank you.
Congratulations.
Just a quick question. You said you're out of the Army Guard now?
I'm out, yes.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes, follow up, Senator Boquist.
I'd like to thank you for your testimony and again go back and thank Sabina for her testimony, mainly this one for her husband who's still a corporal in the military. And I was late this morning, Madam Chair, and I think this is very relevant to the committee. I was late this morning, and I should mention, back on the retribution block, because some years ago, some individuals were asked by members of Congress and civilian leadership in the military or the Department of Defense if they would, after they had gotten out, to come back in, not gotten out, still in the reserve, but off active, if they would come back and they checked with the chain of command of which I was in, and we said, it's civilian oversight. Unfortunately for all of them, the retribution was very swift from the Pentagon in the uniformed service for them providing testimony to members of Congress and members of the civilian leadership of the Department of Defense. And so all these people who come up and provide this information are always at a risk, despite being in the 21st century and despite being in the freest country in the world. Retribution exists. It exists today. We've heard examples of it today. Thank you again for your service.
Thank you.
Thank you for your service, and thank you for coming here this morning. You really have been the capstone, at least, of this section, as well as Sabina and Stacy, at least, giving us some insight into how people are coping, some well and some not so well, when folks are deployed and come back. So welcome home. Glad you're back.
It's good to be home. Thank you.
Okay, and with that... finally, Representative Cowan. I apologize. We are over. I hope we can get caught up. I'm going to hand the gavel over to you. Do you want us to
just ceremonial? I'm also. We are already in session.
Okay,
the charge of the Senate Committee is veterans, and
it is.
I would like to expand that, but I'm certainly hoping that the good senators will stay and participate in the emergency services conversation that we need to have, and I thank those who have been here. We don't want to in any way detract from the importance of the veterans conversation, but emergency preparedness is also an equally important responsibility for the state of Oregon. And unfortunately, colleagues, I have just decided to skip the break that I had thought we were going to take, so obviously people will need to take care of themselves.
And I will take full ownership of the breaklessness we're experiencing, and I plan to stay for the rest of the meeting.
That's 5 hours of human service without a break yesterday.
She's doing penance by staying.
Doing penance. Okay.
Mr. Taylor, could you introduce the next section that we need to be talking about?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have prepared invited testimony as it relates to emergency preparedness, and I believe Ken Murphy and a lady from the Department of Justice will first be discussing the government responses to emergencies under both Chapter 401 and Chapter 433. So this will give the committee a framework of the current statutory provisions as it relates to the two different separate areas as emergency preparedness, one being a natural disaster, for example, an earthquake or a tsunami, the other being a pandemic.
That's right.
And then we will hear from four different agencies on their plans if we are hit with a catastrophic event, be it a pandemic or be it an earthquake.
Thank you. In way of introduction, this is sort of an ongoing conversation that we have about emergency preparedness, and I have promised Mr. Murphy that I would add my usual soapbox that says this governmental planning for our response to an emergency can never take the place of individual preparedness. Government will never be prepared to be on your doorstep in the first 20 minutes of an event that might occur. We don't know what that event might be or where it might be, which is why we spend a great deal of time in public education about how families can be prepared to take care of themselves for the first 48 to 72 hours after any given event. However, it is also imperative that the governmental structures do appropriate planning and be in a position to take on their responsibilities. And we certainly see plenty of examples in a variety of locations that remind us that we have no way of knowing what event might occur. So we're not going to focus this on a tsunami or an earthquake. We're going to focus our conversation on a all events sort of preparedness. And if you could very briefly review these two statutory methodologies for declaring disaster, what we really want to do is get into the heart of the conversation today and the four agencies that we've invited to talk about their specific situations.
Madam Chair, could I just make a brief...
Certainly,
yeah,
Senator.
Ken, thank you for being here, and I am very, very, very disappointed that we did not continue the joint committee that we were involved in a couple of years ago, because there's a big gap now, and we need to work on this all, you know, continuously. So anyway, thank you very much for...
Senator, thank you for your comment. We are going to encourage Senate leadership to make it Veterans and Emergency Services, just like the House side, right?
Yes. I've been told.
It's been suggested.
I need a joint committee.
Actually, that would be a good idea.
Yes, it would be helpful. Thank you. Mr. Murphy, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairs. My name for the record is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, which is part of the Oregon Military Department, and I will be brief, and you have a copy of the slides, so I will quickly go through those so we can talk to some of the points, in looking at disasters and some of the issues that we have to deal with, which I think will help inform you if you don't already know. And I've put copies of the actual ORS 401 with your packets that go into a little bit more detail. I left them off the slides.
Is this information available to us electronically? There are members of our committee who would prefer their material electronically.
Yeah. yes, that is no problem. And
thank you.
I think, you know, what I'll mention today will, you know, dovetail into our further conversations with state agencies and then also what my colleague here, Shannon O'Fallon, and then even into the end of the day when we talk about the SJR, you know, from the past or the SJR 6. So I'll just get started here real quick-like, and I appreciate Chair Cowan's comments. It's one of those things that, you know, we always think about, and I just remind everybody that disasters don't recognize any jurisdictional lines, any group of people. Disasters share their horribleness with anybody. And quick mission statement that I'll go over. A couple points that I wanted to highlight here. Really, in the beginning of ORS 401, it talks about the policies and purposes of emergency management. And I just wanted to highlight in the dark green that's on the slides that it's the state's purpose to prepare for emergencies, but shall not assume authority or responsibility for responding to an emergency unless the appropriate response is beyond the capability of the city and county in which the emergency occurs and the city fails to act or an emergency involves two or more counties. That's really there, you know, for the intended purposes of, you know, the very simple things. You know, if you have the leadership of a city or a county, elected, appointed officials, whomever, that are either killed in the event or injured or not capable of performing their duties, that we do have the ability to step in and help out and those kind of things. And then if the event is such of a great nature, magnitude, and severity, we can also step in and help out in that. The second bullet there, I just want to highlight, you know, that it is a responsibility of the executive officer or governing body of each county or city in this state to have an emergency service system in their jurisdiction. So it's always important, you know, when I go out and speak to communities across the state, that they do have that responsibility. Declarations, I think most everybody here is somewhat familiar that we have declaration processes, and I will just highlight a couple things on this page. When you have a disaster, we always encourage cities and counties, you know, to think about declaring a disaster, even if it's not that bad, because depending on your city or county ordinances, a declaration provides you some escape mechanisms from some of the typical processes. So, and then that is no different, as you'll see in some of my further slides, that under a state declaration, it allows the governor to do some things, you know, to help move the disaster process along and provide services to our citizens of the state of Oregon. The other thing in the highlighted green that I wanted to mention, which I think is an important part of our discussion, is that there is a succession of command. We try and take into account if the governor or the adjutant general, my superior, is not available, that the secretary of state and the treasurer are the succession of command. And then if the adjutant general is not available, then I will carry out his duties to make us go through the process that we can do disaster declarations. I'm not going to do this little pretty slide. You'll see this in your packet. This is just the process of a declaration. Few more comments on declarations here, just to talk about even if the governor is unavailable or has been determined to not be able to do his or her job, what the Secretary of State and the State Treasurer does still has the force of the governor, but there is a time frame. As it mentions here in some of the verbiage, if the governor does not set aside the proclamation within 24 hours of being reached, the proclamation shall be considered affirmed by the governor. So if the Secretary of State or the Treasurer makes a declaration and they make their statements in the declaration and the governor doesn't change within that time frame, then it's considered affirmed. And I will mention on this slide, it's not highlighted, the declarations, you know, do have to specify a certain geographical area, and albeit somewhat bureaucratic, you know, those are parts and pieces that we need to have on the paper as we do assessments to be able to get reimbursement for things through the federal government or the state government. Very quickly on governor's powers, these are just some highlighted areas. There's more in ORS 401, and obviously, as you'll hear from Shannon O'Fallon, powers under 433 in the statutes. But anyway, I wanted to highlight just a few of these. The governor has complete authority over all executive agencies of the state government and the right to exercise within that area designated in the proclamation. During a state of emergency, the governor has the authority to suspend provisions of any order or rule or of any state agency. And then also during a state of emergency, the governor has the authority to direct any agencies in state government to utilize and employ state personnel, equipment, and facilities. And under this current governor, with Governor Kulongowski, I will say we've been very proactive with state agencies and with the governor to go do things even before we have a declaration, in the interest of taking care of our citizens or the visitors to our state. And I think that's important, that we're consistently proactive, you know, to try and do these things. And, you know, the paperwork will catch up later to do that. Additional powers that I think are worth mentioning and important in this process, depending on the severity of the disaster, civil unrest, problems that could happen, which you've seen in Hurricane Katrina and other disasters around the country, that the governor can assume control of all emergency operations in an area in the proclamation, can assume control of all police and law enforcement activities, close all roads and highways, and designate persons to coordinate the work and public and private relief agencies and so forth. So it really does provide some very substantial powers under the declaration process, you know, with the intent of helping the local jurisdictions and the citizens of our communities. One of the other big issues in a big disaster, and also in a small disaster, is housing. It's very important that people have a place to go, you know, once if their home is destroyed or they can't not get back to their home. And during a declared emergency and with the President's declaration, major disasters, we can do some things to enter into the purchase, lease, and other arrangements of agencies of the United States or the state of Oregon for temporary housing. And I will make a side note, we're working with the Department of Human Services and Oregon Housing and Community Services to have a very well thought out, robust plan internal to Oregon, you know, that we can use our resources to support this so that we can get our citizens into some type of housing during a disaster. And then we'll just move right here on to managing resources. No surprise to anybody, resources are incredibly important during any type of disaster. And it's very important. We've even experienced this a little bit during our H1N1 pandemic flu, where you have people that might want to price gouge on the sale of N95 masks or whatever the case may be. So we have the power under the governor's declaration to restrict, regulate, ration, freeze quotas, prohibitions against certain things. You know, because unfortunately in our today's world, we do have people that follow disasters around the country, and they're not of the most upright and forthright citizens, and they'll try and charge money extra. So we have a lot of these abilities to direct those activities and protect our citizens in the process of recovering and using the resources. And, of course, we always try, and this is true across any state, you know, that the resources we need, we want to give the opportunity to Oregon businesses and Oregonians so that they can use their talents and skills to provide those resources. And I'll keep it that simple and short, and I'll make one comment, even though you might not believe it, during any type of disaster that we would have here in Oregon, does not matter what, we will have a public health component. So I will turn it over to my colleague here and let her describe ORS 433.
I fully believe the public health component. Thank you, Ken and Shannon. Welcome.
Yeah, I don't know if you want me to take the time to load up my PowerPoint. It's pretty short, and I can make sure. I don't know if you have copies, but I can make sure you
if
get
you
it electronically.
Just, actually, yeah, rather yeah. than get us hard copies, just get us electronic copies
sure.
and kind of cover it as a lead into the agency presentations.
Okay.
That would be great.
So under 433.441, the governor can also declare what's called a public health emergency. And a public health emergency, you know, has a long definition. It of course, includes something like a pandemic, something that's highly contagious and that poses a high probability of widespread exposure with significant risk of harm to the public. If the governor declares a public health emergency, the governor has all the broad powers the governor would have under sort of a regular emergency under S-401. There are some additional things that are spelled out in 443. The governor can close or order the evacuation of facilities that might endanger the public's health. So if there were an anthrax release, for example, in a facility, the governor could order the evacuation of that. The governor can regulate and restrict medicines, medical supplies, other goods or services that can assist in the public health response. The governor could, again, evacuate large areas, direct people to use transportation in a particular way, use particular modes of transportation. Again, sort of anything that would be needed in order to best respond to the public health emergency. The other important thing that a declaration of public health emergency does is it gives the state public health director, in this case Mel Cohn, some additional authority as well. The public health director can coordinate the public health response across the state, prescribe measures for controlling disease. That could be isolation or quarantine measures, things like that. Adopt additional disease reporting requirements for healthcare facilities. Could allocate medicines and medical supplies, again, to hospitals and other healthcare providers if there were a shortage. Require people to obtain treatment, to get vaccinated, and, of course, there are some due process measures built in there. Of course, if someone has some sort of a religious or conscientious objection, you know, treatment's not going to be ordered over someone's objection, but it is something that can be ordered. And again, take control of and allocate and distribute medicines and medical supplies. The public health director can close schools if a school district for some reason wasn't taking those measures themselves. And then with approval from the governor, sort of take any other measures necessary to respond to the public health emergency. There's also something called a mid-level public health emergency. So in a case where the governor has not declared an emergency, the public health director can ask the governor for some additional authorities. But again, a declaration is not needed. And that's in a case where you have local jurisdictions that are being overwhelmed by some sort of public health threat. There's a public health threat that's of a regional concern or that requires a great deal of state and federal coordination. And then in those cases, the governor would approve the public health director to undertake any of those measures that I just talked about in a declared emergency. And this is an authority that was used during H1N1. It was sort of a jesting case, but the governor did authorize the public health director to utilize some of those additional authorities. In the absence of a declaration or the approval of a governor, both the state public health director and local public health administrators can petition the court for isolation or quarantine orders, and in some emergency cases can actually issue administrative orders to isolate or quarantine an individual. Public health can take broad actions to control disease generally, can restrict persons who work in schools or child care facilities or food service facilities if they are in a communicable stage of a restrictable disease. And in times of a vaccine shortage, can set priorities for who should get vaccine first. So that's a quick and dirty overview of public health law. I don't know if you want to hear about the social distancing law project now or if you would like me to come back and talk about that later.
Well, since you're here, I think just excuse me very briefly that will lead into the human services piece of this presentation and perhaps just give us a heads up if there is anticipated legislation on the issue.
Okay. So the Social Distancing Law Project was funded by the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, and it was a small grant. It had a number of components. One was to do a legal assessment of the state's authority to implement social distancing measures. So social distancing measures are things that you would put in place to try to keep your infection rates down if there were a pandemic. And we looked at restricting movement of persons, closing public places, canceling mass gatherings, and closing schools. Those were the types of things that we looked to see whether or not we had the authority, the legal authority, to do those. And the conclusion was that, in fact, you know, the governor and the public health director during a declared emergency have broad authorities to implement those social distancing measures. We held an exercise on May 12th in Portland and Bend and Medford where, you know, we sort of exercised these authorities and tried to figure out how we would implement them and coordinate them. Out of that, there were a couple highlights. One, it may be that local jurisdictions need to think about adopting ordinances so that they can, in fact, implement such these social distancing measures, specific ordinances to allow them to close public places, for example, or cancel mass gatherings. Enforcement of social distancing measures was a big sort of question mark. You know, how do you enforce them? Sort of what amount of force would be used by law enforcement if you did need to enforce them. And then there was a huge liability issue. If the government's really going in and saying, okay, you know, all non-essential businesses, you know, are closed for a week or 2 weeks to try to slow the spread of disease, maybe buy you some time to get vaccine out to people, you know, does the state have liability for that? What's the extent of the state's liability? It's not apparent to me at this time that there's any legislative fixes that need to happen to make sure that we could implement social distancing measures, but I think that there are things to be done in the planning realm that can get us a little further down the road.
So what are the next steps for that project, or is there going to be a report coming?
I have a final report that's due this week. We talked about, again, doing some planning and sort of more training and exercises around social distancing and implementing social distancing. I'm talking with a lawyer with Multnomah County Council about drafting model ordinances for local jurisdictions to adopt, so we're looking at that, and trying to coordinate more with law enforcement so that, again, we have a better idea of how law enforcement and public health would work together if we needed to implement these measures.
Okay. Are there any questions on that particular project? Okay. Well, we'll stay tuned if there's more that this committee needs to hear on that subject. Then we're available.
Thank you.
So we will move along with our request to ask four of our agencies today for some updates. It's the state's responsibility to periodically sort of check in and review the agency's emergency preparedness planning and abilities to respond and for them to let us know if there are any policy adjustments that are needed out there that we should be contemplating for the next session. So that's kind of the reasoning that's gone into this. And let's start with the military department.
Seeing how I won't be here next session, I think that'll be...
And at this point, I'm going to offer you about 10 minutes each with about 5 minutes for questions. I think we need to do some timekeeping at this point. And some of my committee members are just shuddering at the amount of paper, and I know that that's in our requirements, so I don't know how we're going
to
work on this electronic piece, but we'll work on it.
All electronic, no paper. So. I mean, you have my support. And I will skip, with your permission, Chair Cowan, I will just skip the PowerPoint. You're getting
great.
That in paper.
Okay.
And I will keep this very brief. Chair Cowan and members of the committees, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, Division of the Oregon Military Department. I'm going to talk about the Oregon Military Department what they have titled their Joint Emergency Operations and Continuity Plan. And you'll have a mission statement slide on the second slide, and I think maybe as you go through the PowerPoint, the third slide that lists all their locations is important, because it's important, you know, to think about as an agency, no matter what state agency you are, where your field offices are, and the preparation of how prepared you are if your primary facilities and how you do business are unavailable. And I'll just get to the crux of the briefing here. And on page 5 of the briefing, I think the first point that I would like to bring to your attention that I think is important in business continuity planning and continuity of operations planning is what I talked about earlier, succession of command. We don't always have the luxury during times of disasters, emergencies, or whatever the case may be, that our typical structure of leadership management or chain of command is available. And of course, one of the benefits of the military is how they have their chain of command system. And on the bottom of that page is just a rough graphic showing underneath the Adjutant General. We have the Deputy Director, General Caldwell, and he is also the commander of the State Defense Force. And then it just succinctly goes down to the two Assistant Adjutant Generals, one for Army and one for Air. And then you can see under their commands, they have two each major components. So the point being is that those men or women that hold those leadership positions, if the Adjutant General wasn't available, that we have the ability in the military department to have those people step in and perform his or her role if they're not available or they're a victim of the disaster. So I think it's important, you know, as we look at continuity of operations in an organization, is who is left that can make decisions. And I would even tell you, down even to the lowest level, and I think about this in my organization also, is who has the authority to sign a paycheck or, you know, some of those behind-the-scenes things that can make things happen. So I think those are important things to think about. But for sure, the leadership of an organization has one, two, three, maybe four layers of people that can assume the role of the leader of that agency in case they're not available. On the page 6, just a little bit more on the backup of the Oregon Military Department and their continuity of operations plan. I think you're all very aware that we have the two fighter wings, one in Portland, one in Klamath Falls. One of the key components of the military department, as it is with many organizations, is we have a what the military department calls a joint operations center that's 24/7, manned 7 days a week, 365 days a year. If for some reason that is not available, these two Air National Guard units can act as backup to provide that operations center that would help manage resources, take information, and provide communication support in case the main joint operations center here in Salem is non-functional or destroyed. And then we also have another Air National Guard unit on third bullet there, combat operations that can provide additional communication support that's more mobile, you know, in case the physical structures of our buildings are damaged or destroyed. And then the Oregon State Defense Force is also there to help maintain that liaison, which we see is very important to have that man or woman representing the Oregon State Defense Force to go be in the county emergency operations center to help provide information back here to the state level. And then more specific on page 7 about my operation and the Joint Operations Center of the National Guard located in the Anderson Readiness Center, not too far down the street from here. We've developed our internal continuity of operations plan in case the Anderson Readiness Center is not functional or usable. And we've combined our forces between the two organizations where we have three sites here, two in Salem and one in Polk County in Dallas, where we are able to pick up the basics, computers, telephones, whatever we need, and move to those alternate sites. And the plan is written. We've done quite a bit of testing on it, but we have not physically deployed, and you'll see there that we're going to try that this summer. And the importance of physically deploying to these sites is just, number one, can you find it? That's part of the plan. And number two, you know, do all your communications and the things that you would need work? And the reason we have three is because the other two or all three could be bad. Obviously, we all know there's a nice big river and lots of bridges between here and Polk County, and so you have to be flexible enough, you know, on how you make these arrangements. And currently, right now, we have what I would call your pretty standard truck and trailer system, you know, that will take us to these locations and haul our equipment, some tentage, and our people. We are, the military department, as you'll see there on the third bullet, is seeking federal monies to try and purchase a little bit bigger, more robust command and control vehicle, one that would provide the ability to have the adjutant general or the governor or whomever in a small meeting room and have a more of a mobile operations post, something a little bit more substantial than a pickup truck and a trailer. But we are working on trying to get federal funds to do that. The fourth bullet, too, and if you are familiar or not, the Oregon Military Department has a federal computer system and a state computer system, and they just recently have completed all the work to back up and have redundancy for all their federal computer systems and all that information into the Bend area. So that gives us that continuity of operations if the Salem facilities here are destroyed or unusable. And then also the Oregon National Guard, just by the nature of its missions, at each one of their facilities, whether it's Air National Guard or Army National Guard, and their bases and camps have communication systems, albeit military frequencies, are still able to provide baseline communications between the facilities. And then we are also working to improve that capability by putting amateur radio sites in each one of those military locations. That is all I have, pending any questions.
Thank you. Yes, I have a couple questions. We have merged the Office of Emergency Management into the military department, and from this presentation, it has a fairly military structure to it, which leads me to the thought process that we're pretty good at the initial emergency response setup. Design of an incident command base and the basic food and shelter sort of requirements and communication systems that might be sort of the first thing that pops into mind after whatever a all hazards emergency event might be. Where do you see then the rest of our state structure in terms of what I look at as a bigger picture of emergency management, the communications with the local jurisdictions, public health? I was thinking about private business, the availability of goods and supplies to people, perhaps contractors to do necessary repair work. The rest of that infrastructure of any given community, how do we pull that back together or help it function during an emergency situation?
Chair Cowan,
complicated
question.
No, simple question, right?
And as you know, with your experience in disasters, a little bit depends on the type of disaster it is. But if it's a bad one, and I'll always go to my favorite earthquake that shakes and rattles at least all of Western Oregon and probably an associated tsunami, You know, and my comments would be some of this we surely have done, and there's more that we can do before the event. And as we talk about state agency preparedness, one of the things that we need to do as a state is, you know, my colleagues behind me, when they brief, do I know where all of their offices are? Do I know all of their telephone numbers? And do I know all of their alternate means of communications? Because if we have a bad enough disaster, you know, my first assumption, although I'll be testing it, will be our normal communications means are non-functional. And so I think, you know, prior to any type of an event, you know, do we know where all of these state agencies are? Do we know the same thing at cities and counties? You know, do they have a business continuity or a continuity of operations plan? If city government, if a county courthouse, or, you know, where a mayor or the city councilors are, you know, do we have the knowledge of where they might be? The other way around that, too, is to put out some base information to all the jurisdictions in Oregon that would give different radio frequencies, amateur radio frequencies, and alternate communications for them to check in if they can within a certain amount of time after any type of disaster. But bringing it back up to the state perspective, I think it's important that we continue to build the coordination. It's number one is each state agency having the proper plans of how they're going to operate if they can't use their normal equipment and buildings, and then how we can connect in that scenario so that we can, as quick as possible, provide the citizens and the communities and the counties with those resources. And I would tell you the answer is a little bit similar to the private sector. You know, and we've done a lot of work in coordinating with different pieces of the private sector, not all of them, but some of the bigger agencies, surely utilities, fuel, and some of the commercial retail sector, like Walmart, Target, those kind of things that have stores full of things that people want. And so trying to coordinate with them. I think the other piece that I would finish up in saying is with the private sector, as many pre-event contracts as you can put in place that don't cost the state any money until you execute them. And I'll give you two examples. There's a heavy lift consortium of helicopter companies in Oregon, and they have tons of resources. And we've met with them a couple times to talk about how they could use helicopters to help out. And so you could do a pre-event contract with these helicopter companies, you know, and what they could provide and how they could provide it. In fact, I just met yesterday with a group out of the Bend area that provides base camps. Primarily, they've started their industry in forest fires and those kind of things, but they've had a lot of experience since Hurricane Katrina. In fact, I think they're deploying some base camps to Louisiana because they found it's much cheaper to keep everybody in a tent on the beach than drive them all the way back into cities to stay in hotels. And we talked about a pre-event contract about how to bring in these base camps that would have tentage, for people to live in, food, water, electricity, sanitation, you know, and set up a pre-event contract of where we could say, this is what we need, here are the locations that we think we might put them, and try and do everything ahead of time, except for sign the bottom line that would cost us money. So I think those are the things, and as you well know, the more we can do before the event without expending too much money, if at all possible, will save us a lot of time and lives.
I guess a follow-up to that, it just sort of jogged my mind. I, because of some way past experience in forest fires, and the base camps that were necessary to support those operations. Do you communicate with the Forest Service, both state and federal, because they have some pretty amazing resources available to set up a camp quickly?
Absolutely, Chair Cowan. In fact, that's where I've done a little, you know, I'm a believer of not inventing anything new. I'll steal anybody's ideas. And that's where I ran into some of this, because I've spent some time in fires. you know, and looked at these elaborate layouts that they have, and I says, how did you get this? Because I knew they didn't have that much money in forestry. That's where I actually, you know, saw it. I was stationed on the Biscuit Fire in 2002 down in Gold Beach, and it was just amazing. They set this city up for 2,500 people, but it was a contractor. And so my point being, to answer your question, is the Department of Forestry have these pre-event contracts. So, you know, I took some lessons from them, what they learned, how they implemented them. You know, who do you call at, you know, 2:30 in the morning on Sunday and wake them up and tell them you need everything in the world delivered right away? And so I think a lot of those answers are out there, and I've just investigated other people that do something similar and just have plagiarized their ideas.
So that is an ongoing effort of your office.
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to be put on the hotel list. I am a firm believer.
You don't
believer.
Want a tent?
I don't want a tent on the beach is what I don't want, because I know that tsunami's going to come. But if I'm in town, I'd like to be in the hotel, please. Thank you.
We'll work on that, Representative Boone. We'll get after that, and you can give me your top 10 list.
Okay.
Some of us are getting to the point where tents aren't as attractive as they might have been once upon a time.
Do tell.
It's that water part that I don't
like. Chair Cowan, I will tell you, they got some really nice tents nowadays. You know,
it is true.
Very nice.
Follow-up, more seriously, you touched on something, and I don't know where I heard it, but it was somebody else's idea. And they sold some sort of tent that was, you set it up like a tent, and then you spray it, and it's got concrete on it. Already, so it stiffens up into being a structure that can be actually waterproof and more permanent in that sense.
Chair Cowan, Representative Moon, you know, and obviously in our process of this, you know, we look to try and take use of Oregon companies, and there's one in, and I'm probably not going to get this right, I think Milwaukee, Oregon, called Miles Fiberglass, and they worked with a company in Alaska, and they have these unassembled, I know we'll get all this right, igloos.
Oh, yeah.
And not too different than a yurt. Mm-hmm. And they're palletized, you know, and I'm looking for, you know, what's convenient and what can be airlifted or shipped in a truck. And they come in different segments, 2 people, 4 people, 6 people, and very easy to put together. They're a hardened fiberglass type material, and then they connect because they're igloos, and you can develop a little city.
Wow.
So I was impressed.
Cool. Geodesic domes?
Kind of the same principle, Representative Riley. But I was looking more, you know, what's quick to assemble, easy to break apart, you know, put on a standard pallet type thing that can easily be moved.
And I guess my final comment is I was just talking with Representative Riley. This sounds familiar from back in the day when we started these committees, and I recall having that discussion of some sort of asset management and plan management that was coordinated among all, you know, upper being the state, and then the county and city governments, and everybody's plans, and then big, like, school districts, hospitals, stuff like that, so that you could just somehow push a button or, you know, call somebody and they'd know, and that you would have it, and so you would know, and then you could, you know, do the reverse 911 calls or whatever and let everybody know, but that everybody had it, and right down to a separate legislation where we had plans for nursing homes, assisted living schools, et cetera, daycares, so they had an emergency plan, and I think that was all part of that, and so I don't know where that is at this point.
Chair Cowan, Representative Boone, pieces and parts of that are in place, and I won't speak for the Department of Human Services. I do know in working with them, a lot of our rest homes, care facilities, and things like that do have emergency plans. But I'll just be very candid with you. When you, just what we're talking about today, if you lost a care home or an assisted living facility, it is not that easy to replicate the needs of that population in a tent. And, you know, and I've talked to my friends in the Department of Human Services, and there's not a single day that I don't learn something new, you know, because of all of these issues. You know, it's the transportation of these people, and you got to have certain types of machinery or electrical needs or caregivers, you know, depending on, you know, what the situation is. And so we've been working as a team, which you'll hear a little bit about today, I think, on mass care, sheltering, feeding, and housing. And it's complicated, very complicated, you know, as is pet evacuation.
Yes.
Okay, well then, I think we will very quickly move to our Human Services Department. I guess the one question that I would ask of you that I'm going to ask of each presenter today, fair warning, is there any potential legislative need for the next session? Are you anticipating any policy change that this committee would need to be bringing forward in the next session?
Chair Cowan, nothing as it relates to anything that we've talked about here today. I do have some legislative concepts, but not dealing with these.
Okay, then we won't bring them out today, but I will ask you to get in touch with me very, very soon as we look at the really tight timeline and limitations that we'll be focused on just in terms of bill numbers and things like that in the next session. I think that's something that this committee is going to need to be reviewing at the September Interim Committee, and it'll need to be really formalized and compact by then. So please be in touch soon.
Thank you, Chair Cowan.
With our administrator. Good morning.
Good morning.
It is still morning.
Yeah, we're
early.
Still there.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeremy Emerson. I represent Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority, too. As you know, House Bill 2009 last session created Oregon Health Authority, but we're doing is envisioning a shared services model whereby some of the support function and business continuity planning would actually be essential and incorporate in our discussions about how we move forward with the two different departments. What I hope to talk to you about today is a little bit about what we're doing in DHS on business continuity management, and then spend a little bit of time on emergency support function 6. You have the handouts in front of you. There's only a few slides. I have this electronically. I will prepare, send it to you, get it to you. And, you know, I'm not aware of any pending legislation with regards to business continuity management, but we really ought to consider it in the new structure that we're going forward on how we're going to operate. I'm certain that we have a long laundry list of things to consider with regards to fixing in statute when we're creating these two agencies or two departments, and we really ought to consider on how we're looking at business continuity going forward. So what have we been doing within the department? We are currently working on our plan. We found that building a business continuity plan is a cyclical thing. You continuously do this. It should be done on a regular basis. I appreciated your comment that individuals need to look out for themselves whilst the agency needs to continually be looking out for how they're operating. And a business continuity plan is actually very useful in all sorts of things, from an economic crisis to a natural disaster. So we're developing this to ensure continuation of our critical functions and to assure agencies' ability to support internal and external response functions. Our plan is going to be have like 6 segments to it, and they're listed there on the first slide. There's a succession planning, delegation of authority. You heard Ken talk a lot about that. This is basically just to account for loss in key staff. Communications, whenever we look at a disaster, disaster. We found that there's a insatiable appetite for information. That's what people want most in the beginning. And our communications plan will cover both form and function. The third item there is alternate strategies and locations. That's an obvious one in business continuity planning. How are you going to do things without your IT systems? How are you going to do things without that building? Those sorts of things. Surge response is a big one. We actually been practicing this. I'll talk a little bit later about that. But that's basically having plans for redeployment of staff. And emergency response, that's really an area that covers tools and methods. An example is our go-karts that we have, where we have a package of laptops that we can put on the road with a IT person and get somebody's an office set up rapidly. And incident management, this is basically just covers a more structured command communication plan. On the second slide, a lot of our focus, we're currently focused on developing an incident communication and response system, an ICR. And this will include and encompass both DHS and Oregon Health Authority. Central office and includes 185 field offices. We roughly have over 12,000 employees. We're hoping that this will be scalable. The ICR has to be scalable where it's flexible for both small and large events. And we're going to have an inventory of our communications tools. So we have like the landlines, we have cell phones, email, of course. Last year we deployed training and awareness and had people tested on the health alert network we call HAN, and that is a system that's operated by our public health system and a lot of local governments, and now DHS is going to be utilizing that as a tool. Of course, we have some satellite phones. They are strategically deployed across the state, and most importantly, they're in places that have frequent windstorms and mudslides. And we also have a few in central office that we can deploy where we might need them. On the third slide, we're contemplating the necessity of an agency operations center, where if you've never visited our agency operations center within the public health department, I would actually invite you to do so. It's pretty impressive, and what's most impressive is even if none of the electronics work in it, we have it's roles-based, and you can see how it operates pretty effectively. We're contemplating doing that same sort of setup for DHS and the Oregon Health Authority, basically to support the emergency support function 6, which I'll talk about in a little bit. We are exercising our business continuity plans on a regular basis. We do that both in real and staged events. We had a number of participants that over a dozen different program areas were represented from DHS for the Cascadia apparel in 2009. And in support of H1N1 in the spring and fall and winter of 2009 through 2010, we basically were practicing how we would handle both a surge in client caseload, which we were having anyway, and also a loss in staff due to illness. We are quarterly exercising the incident communications and response structure, and we're using the Health Alert Network to do that. And then additionally, that's not on the slide here, is that we've actually held a couple of tabletop exercises in various program areas that really our focus on is around the surge and succession planning, surge in caseload, surge in succession planning. Very recently, in fact, as early as yesterday, we have delivered to us an internal audit on how we're doing within DHS for business continuity planning and emergency preparedness. And this is the first one, I believe, and we'll use it as a baseline for how we're doing today in this area and building a roadmap for improvements going forward. And I would be happy to get that electronically to you, too, if you'd like.
Be good. Thank you.
I'm going to pause there. Is there any questions on business continuity planning?
I have one. Is there any connection with the ham radio community? Because we experienced on the coast during the storms that the satellite phones did not work at all.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, we're actually following emergency management folks' lead on that, and we agree that the satellite phones are not the silver bullet. They work in our tests, and we're actually we test them regularly. And however, we really need to actually not just put all our eggs in that basket on satellite phones. So I appreciate the question.
I'm going to ask you to keep moving here.
All right, very good. So my next slide.
I'm sorry, did I miss you? Yeah.
Sorry. My next slide talks a little bit about just the final four slides. Emergency Support Function 6. Department of Human Services has been designated in the state plan under emergency management as being the lead agency. This has been a great project that we've been working on. ESF 6, if you're not familiar with it, is about food, shelter, housing, financial benefits, and other human services. We have been doing some interagency planning since May of 2009 with other agencies, volunteer organizations, and faith-based organizations. And the obvious reason we've been working with both volunteer and the faith-based organization is they have expertise and vast experience in delivering some of those things that I just mentioned, food, shelter, and emergency housing. So state agencies on the next slide are listed there that are participating actively. We meet monthly, and that's, of course, Department of Human Services, Oregon Health Authority, Agriculture, Emergency Management, and Housing and Community Service. And then our adjunct agencies and community partners are on the next slide in the table. You'll see a lot of them are faith-based and not-for-profit organization, but I will call out that American Red Cross has really been a principal contributor to our planning and all efforts around how we're going to put together a really good plan for our state. And then the last slide is basically what we're working on now. Ken mentioned it earlier. This is a subgroup of the Emergency Service Function team. It's a Housing Task Force subcommittee, the plan will include for how we would actually put in place short-term shelters, interim housing, resources, and long-term housing. That's the main focus right now in a small committee made up of some of those agencies I named before. So that's what I have to share.
Thank you, Ms. Gershon. As I, you know, review this and look through, what's the role with the American Red Cross as you look for shelter and all these emergency services? Are they a component?
They have
of this?
Yes, yeah. And they have been an active partner in our planning, bringing to bear all of their experience. So we typically have at least two, sometimes three representatives from the Red Cross at our monthly meetings, and they are they're really good at not just providing emergency shelter, but they dedicate a lot of resources for transition to interim housing or permanent housing also. And they've been very helpful in kind of talking through how our state of Oregon plan ought to work.
Yeah, and I do mention that because I actually do serve on the board of the Oregon Trail Chapter, and I'm meeting with their executive director today. So I'm pleased to see them here on the slide that they're an integral component of this.
Because very much.
They know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
They know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, we sincerely hope these plans won't be tested in the near future. But
well, I think I'd love to test them, just not in reality.
You can test them in simulations.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Cohn, did you have a presentation?
I like simulations better than real.
Chair Cowan, Chair Schrader, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the director of the Public Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority, Department of Human Services. First, I want to really thank you for having this hearing today, because it's a natural, it's human nature to not think about the unthinkable. And continuity planning, continuity of operations planning, that's really what it's about, is thinking through the unthinkable and starting to put in place the pieces that you're going to need should it happen. And that was one of the reasons why last summer, when the governor convened the influenza summit, we had a major focus on continuity of operations planning, not just for state agencies, but for communities, the business sector, and so forth. Very, very critical part of our response to any disaster. So what have we done in the public health world? And I am grateful that Mr. Murphy told me that we're going to be involved in every disaster. I guess I should be thankful for that acknowledgement, although it's an awful lot of work and a lot of responsibility to carry out. We do have a continuity of operations plan, both for the division as a whole and several of our mission-critical functions, for example, disease investigation, outbreak investigation, our vital record system, for example, you need death certificates for burials to take place. Those are legal documents, very, very important. With the flu pandemic, we did have an opportunity to exercise many of these functions, although we were not stressed to the point where we needed to go into full mode of implementing those plans. The question that was sent to me was about succession of command for the agency and how deep it is. As the state health officer, I do have certain statutory authorities that Shannon O'Fallon recommended. And by the way, let me just as an aside recognize the incredible leadership that Shannon has shown around all of these issues. I want to make sure that the committee is aware that she is nationally seen and respected for a lot of the work that she's done around this. So we're very, very lucky to have her here. But because I have those statutory authorities, I do have a plan for delegation of authority. There are two other physicians. We don't have very many physicians in the State Health Department. Most of our staff are non-physicians. But there are, because many of the duties require medical knowledge, I have Dr. Grant Higginson and Dr. Katrina Hedberg as the people, should I not be available, that those authorities would be delegated to. In terms of our field offices, there are a variety of ways to look at what you might consider our field offices. So in the strictest sense of the word, we have five preparedness coordinators that are stationed around the state. Those folks are critical for us in terms of getting information into us about what's happening out there, and also conduits to get information out to local communities. So that is a feature of our structure that I think facilitates continuity of operations. Many of our services are provided through county health departments, and they are not, the folks in these health departments are county employees. They are not state employees, so they're not field offices in the way that might be meant in some other state agencies. But we are part of the system, and we depend on each other in order to get the job done. All of the local health departments have done continuity of operations planning as part of our preparedness work over the last few years. And I would say that in H1N1, I think some of the limits of continuity of operations were really tested in a number, particularly of our smaller counties. And what I mean is that if you have a health department where you have one or two people who are the people who deal with communicable disease issues, there isn't much continuity of operations planning you can do. You just don't have that much resource there in the agency. And that means you're going to have to depend on other people in the community, and that becomes a much more complicated endeavor. So I think the kind of preparedness that we really need to have is linked to the fundamental strength and how thinly resourced right now our local health department system is. And I say that with great deal of respect for my local health department colleagues. They are, to a person, terrific, and trying to do as much as they can with whatever they have. I know that's not a message in these very difficult fiscal times that anybody wants to hear, but I think it is a reality. Two areas where, for me, during H1N1, this was particularly driven home. One was around a health officer capacity. There is a statutory requirement for every local health department to have a health officer, a local health officer. But in fact, what that translates into in many of our county health departments is a physician who has little or no training in public health, who gives 2 to 4 hours a month to the health department. That's not a lot of time. And so I think this is an area of vulnerability that we need to think about. How can we strengthen our health officer system? Another area, Jeremy mentioned the issue of communications. We have done a lot of work to build our communications capacity at the state, and I think knitting that together with our local health departments was another area that was difficult for us during H1N1. But in terms of how are we going to be able to continue what we do, very, very critical function. Then going out one ring even further out, you might consider our field offices to be hospitals, doctor's offices, and so forth. We do a lot of work with these partners. I think that H1N1 was a wake-up call for many of them to really take this relationship seriously and work in earnest and figure out what they're going to do when things really look like they're heading for trouble. And I think we made a lot of progress on that front, and we have a lot more work to do in the future around that. The second question that I had was a question about communication. If our phones and email are down, what other modes do we have? The Health Alert Network, I think Mr. Murphy already mentioned that. The HOSCAP system, which is a federal system that hospitals report their bed capacity into. We have access to that. That's very important information for us to use in terms of deploying resources and figuring out what the needs are out there. And we also do have 169 satellite phones that are deployed to our partners out in the state, local health departments, and our state staff. We do, in addition, participate in something called the National Public Health Radio Network. Representative Boone, that may be the kind of function that you were asking about. I have to confess I'm not terribly knowledgeable about it, but if you'd like some more information about that, I'd be happy to find out some more. But the entire communication system that we have is tested 3 times a year so that we make sure that all of these various options are functioning as well as they can. And there's a fair amount of redundancy in the system as well, so that if you don't hear about it from on the satellite phone, you'll hear about it on hand, or you know, vice versa. Then the third question was about an agency operations center, Jeremy, Mr. Emerson was very kind to talk about our operations center. It was extremely helpful for us to have this facility. I think it's terrific that the department is talking about how to organize itself similarly, and we will be supporting that in every way that we can. We do train our staff regularly, and H1N1, again, in a way, was kind of a massive training opportunity for us, and I think we all learned a lot individually about that. We did have our agency activation center was activated for 12 consecutive days last April, and then 158 consecutive days we were in incident management mode, meaning that we used the incident management structure to guide our work, with the AOC open for 72 of those days during wave 2 of the flu pandemic. So I think we've gained quite a bit of experience about how to make that functional, and I think as we got on in the pandemic, it got better and better. Two other things I just want to mention. One is that we do have two alternate AOC sites. One is at the State Public Health Laboratory, which is located out in Hillsborough, so that if our offices at the Portland State Office Building were not occupiable for one reason or another, we could go out there. And the other is the Oregon Department of Transportation field office in Clackamas County. So we do have that kind of those agreements and so forth in place as well. And then finally, I do want to mention that the state's emergency communications center that the military department oversees, we would deploy staff into that in should there be a situation where that was activated as well. That wasn't really necessary this time around for pandemic flu, but certainly in other kinds of disasters, it would be. I would expect it to be activated. So thank you. I'll be happy to answer questions if time permits.
Any questions?
I just want to thank you for your insistence and persistence on the hand washing issue during the flu time. And I think that that really was one of the key reasons we didn't see more. Because everywhere I went, there were new signs plastered up for people to wash hands and connecting it to the flu and all that. And I think people, I saw more people, you know, sneezing into their arms and stuff like that. But anyway, those were simple fixes that I think that you harped on incessantly, at least to us. And I know that it kind of permeated the whole state because it was everywhere I went, and it seemed to start at about that time we started hearing it from you.
It was very effective messaging.
Yeah.
Chair Cowan, Representative Boone, thank you very much for that. You know, we also vaccinated almost twice the number of people. If you look at the seasonal flu shots and the H1N1 shots that were given that we had in years past. That is a huge logistical triumph as far as I'm concerned. With all of the issues that we had with vaccine supply and so forth, I think that was really a very, very impressive achievement that I hope also had something to do with decreasing transmission.
No, and I never had my H1N1. I did have the seasonal. By the time they became available, I was off traveling or doing something. And I did get the flu or something in China, and they think that's what it was. When I came home, I went to the doctor, and she says, I think you got it. So,
one area in that regard that I you may be hearing some more from us about will be in the area of healthcare worker vaccination, because I think that is an area that nationally we did not do as well as we should have. It's a huge patient safety concern, and there's a lot of work to be done around that.
Thank you. I'm going to let us move on, and we're going to try to squeeze in still the Oregon State Police and the Department of Transportation. So,
my husband and his entire crew on the fire department all got shots. But that was the first time I've seen them do that.
Cool.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Cowan, members of the committee. My name is David Yendell. I am the director of the Criminal Justice Information Services Division for the Oregon State Police, and I also serve as the Business Continuity Plan Coordinator for the department. Joining me is also Captain Travis Hampton, commander of our East Region, headquartered in Bend. The Oregon State Police takes seriously our role in emergency preparedness. Whether performing each and every day, 365 days a year as a first responder, or maintaining plans for the timely restoration of the sole source public safety-related critical business functions we provide, we understand the significance of being prepared. On the traditional law enforcement side of the department, each of our three regions maintain comprehensive emergency operations plans for their respective regions. The plans are revised annually and tested daily based on the mission of our organization and the services we provide. In March of 2006, under statewide policy issued by the Department of Administrative Services, OSP joined 11 other state agencies in developing business continuity plans, identifying critical business functions, and establishing their recovery time objectives. The department currently maintains critical business function plans for law enforcement, our core mission for the department. The law enforcement data system, many of you know as LEDS, the state medical examiner, forensic services, or the state crime labs, identification services, the office of state fire marshal, and both our northern and southern command centers. Each plan is updated annually with a goal to also see each plan tested annually. Business continuity plan status reports are an included agenda item on our monthly leadership team meetings, and we emphasize making BCP and emergency preparedness an integral part of our day-to-day business. Captain Hampton and I appreciate the opportunity to appear here before you this morning. We'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have regarding the response to the questions, which I believe you should have already received a copy of, but if you have any specific questions about our response, we'd be happy to answer them at this time.
Are there any questions? Well, we, I guess, feel very confident that you're ready to be there for us at any time in any place, and that certainly is usually our experience with state police. You pop up in all sorts of interesting places as we travel our roads.
I wish you wouldn't.
Chair Cowan, if I might, and we want to be very brief, I did want to point out that one of the benefits that I think that we enjoy being located at the Anderson Readiness Center is our proximity to the Office of Emergency Management and our partners with ODOT. For many of you that may not be familiar with that facility, when the building was constructed, it was in a spirit of partnership with the Oregon Military Department, the Office of Emergency Management, and ODOT, specifically to co-locate our 24-hour operations centers. If you've not visited that facility and you were there today, you would notice that ODOT's command center for this region, the State Police Command Center for the Northwest region, as well as the combined, consolidated 24/7 operations center for the law enforcement data system and the State Office of Emergency Management's Oregon Emergency Response System are all co-located together for coordination purposes. And they are right next door to the state's Emergency Coordination Center. So I feel very honored that we were given the opportunity to be co-located in that facility for some of the very reasons that you're concerned about hearing from state agencies today.
I guess that begs the question. We appreciate that co-location and the coordination. What if something happened to Anderson Readiness Center?
Madam Chair, each of the participating agencies would be looked to establish their alternate site utilizing their BCP or looking for direction from the Office of Emergency Management regarding an alternative site from which to conduct our business. Our own department's philosophy is that we have multiple sites from which we can conduct our business. We would anticipate that if the Anderson Readiness Center was not operational or available to us, we have a number of different alternate locations that we could conduct our work from.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Moon.
I'm sorry to be asking so many questions, but
it's just lunch.
I don't get lunch today, I don't think. I was going to ask if, and I know you're not the people doing the Owen, but you are involved, but is that factored into your plan to the wireless internet interoperability network?
Chair Cowan, Representative Boone, we certainly would hope to reap the benefits of the Owen project once it's completed. I think the status of the project at this point maybe isn't far enough along to specifically take into account how the new capabilities that are emerging from that project might further assist us. But absolutely, we would anticipate that we would benefit.
Well, we follow up on that. Oh. We, in our border tour, Representative Freeman and I did a 3-day border tour up through Canada, BC mostly, and Vancouver, and along the border and in all the usual places. But they have a similar system up there, too, and they're doing it across border between BC and state of Washington. And they try to do it along their plan is to do it along the border there, connected with the PNEMA, the Pacific Northwest, you know, whatever it stands for, emergency management system, whatever. They're working on coming from the east side, too, so that there's a I mean, and Ken, you might know more about this, too, or General Caldwell, the international, interstate, interprovincial connections, radio, emergency management, all that that's going on. And I just wondered how that factors into Oregon, because we're down one state. But we do all belong to that system. We signed an agreement through statute some years ago and codified it last year to join that effort.
Chair Cowan, Representative Boone, I'm assuming you're talking about the Emergency Management Assistance Compact?
Is that the PNEMA thing? Is that
there's the compact organizations. Representative Boone is referring to the Pacific Northwest Emergency Management Arrangement, and that particular one is a mutual aid agreement between Alaska, Oregon, Washington, the province of British Columbia, and the territory of Yukon. And very similar to everything you've heard here today, we work with those two Canadian territory and province on business continuity, communications, everything. We share ideas. And I will just add to the group, I'm part of the National Emergency Management Association, and we're working to do an entire North American mutual aid compact between Canada, the United States, and Mexico. And we just signed some paperwork to do the initial investigations to do it with Australia.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. There are no further questions of these individuals. We'll move on to the Department of Transportation. And thank you for your patience and for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good to report back.
Can you give them a head start?
Yeah.
I'm not heading back till a little later.
Colleagues, because they've been so supportive and patient, we're definitely going to get in the report of the Department of Transportation. I think we've already touched on the social distancing project, and then I'm going to do a mention only of the last item on our agenda. So we'll basically be wrapping up after this with your endurance. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
It is still.
Chair Cowan, members of the Commission, I'm Lucy Moore. I'm the State Maintenance and Operations Engineer for ODOT. I'm here to provide you with an overview of ODOT's Emergency Preparedness Program and answer the key questions you've asked of us.
Thank you.
ODOT has an all-hazards emergency operations plan. As you can see, it's quite large and heavy and extensive. It supports response to a wide range of incidences, from computer system failures, the H1N1 flu, snowstorms, earthquakes, forest fires, floods, etc. It's flexible enough for us to use it on small events, like a crash on the highway, through major emergencies that encompass large portions of the state. It's designed to support the state emergency operations plan and meets the Department of Homeland Security requirements. It sets ODOT's emergency response policy, serves as our business continuity plan, it describes emergency response roles of ODOT and its staff, and it provides a coordinated response with local, state, and federal partners. It also describes how we will be prepared. We review it annually and update more often if something arises that we see we need to do. We also have an employee and family disaster preparedness manual, and we provide it to all of our staff so that they can get their families prepared so that they feel comfortable in coming back and helping us respond to an emergency and not have to worry about their family. We train our staff in a variety of ways for emergency response. Day-to-day small emergencies, they use the principles in the book. for crash scenes and local computer system failures, small storms. We also have formal training in the incident command system and our emergency operations plan. We've had 1,500 people go through the basic incident command system training, and 160 have had advanced level incident command system training. We also participate in state and national drills, such as QuakeX and Top-Off and the Umatilla Depot chemical weapons exercises, which we just participated in this last month. This plan is also our business continuity plan, and DMV has a business-specific continuity plan for business to meet the specific needs of its customers. It includes guidance on computer system recovery priorities and business sustainability priorities. DMV's top priority is to provide personal identity and vehicle ownership data to law enforcement. ODOT has an agency operations center, as you heard earlier. It's also in the Anderson Readiness Center. We have a backup facility in our materials lab, which is right around the corner. We also have 15 district and 5 region centers around the state. DMV and certain parts of our Central Services Division also have emergency centers in Salem. They incorporate into our overall agency operations center structure as necessary. Which centers we open depends on the location, type, and magnitude of the response necessary. Our key positions have positional succession 2 to 3 people deep. One key point we've learned from long duration and widespread events is that it takes quite a few people to manage this response. We've determined that we need to cross-train staff to support the management of the response when it becomes 24/7 for multiple weeks. So we are now developing tools and support documents for our technical and engineering staff to take on roles that are quite different from their daily jobs. We have backup communication systems from our normal phone and email systems. We use our statewide wireless radio system. It's also used daily for our maintenance activities and response to small highway incidences. As a third tier of communication, we also have 11 ham radios that are located across the state. We can use these to communicate with the local emergency centers as well as our own centers if an event requires that we have to go to that level of communication backup. In summary, we have a robust all-hazard emergency operations plan that we continue to refine. We're training our staff and we'll continue to train them on the plan and response. We have the infrastructure in place to support a response. We continue to learn from each storm and event that we participate in. We take this responsibility very seriously, and we will always be looking for ways to improve our preparedness for whatever comes next.
Thank you. I am going to pose a question that's come out of some conversation. Yours is an agency that obviously has plenty of practical experience because we certainly have enough, particularly wintertime events, to test your ability to respond. But the actual on-the-ground repair or clearing of roads isn't always done by ODOT-employed
people.
For a lot of your major operations, you rely on contracting with private entities. And I'm understanding that this can occasionally be challenging when you have an emergency response need and may not have contractors on the ground who are able or willing to take on those responsibilities. Could you address that a little bit? So for I think it's important that we be aware of that challenge.
Sure, Chair Callan. We have a lot of the times our contractors are ready and willing to respond and help us and partner with us in many ways. There are certain situations that we found have been challenging. One example would be commercial vehicle tow truck capabilities. And we've had this in the Gorge where they were not able to respond in a timely manner to get large trucks out of the way, and we've had cars behind them that became emergency situations, almost rescue operations to help get them to a safe environment. They don't have a nice cab to sleep in, and so we had to get them out. One other situation was when we were running short of sanding material. They may not have had the chains they needed to supply more sand to us, so we needed to go get sand from their yard. So that slowed us down, so instead of having staff to go and equipment to go put the sand out on the highway and do other road clearing, we had to take some time and go get the rock ourselves. That type of situation can be rectified if they actually have some chains for their equipment to move out on the highway.
I guess in follow-up, do you pre-contract for emergency situations then?
We have contractor registries, and we have emergency contracting authority so that we can quickly develop contracts for certain needs. We do have contracts in place for design capabilities that we could also use in emergencies.
I raised the issue because of public perception. There's a lot of those big orange trucks out there, and why isn't the road open now? And I think it's important for us to understand what some of the limitations potentially can be. These are basically what you're talking about are winter storms, and if we have major events where there are compromised highways all over the state, that's going to ramp it up just a little bit. So, thank you.
Yeah, by helicopter.
Any other questions, or is everyone simply hungry?
No, I feel like we're really well prepared after hearing everybody's reports. And thank you for all of you for what you do, because we're just hearing the report. You're doing the work. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. We do appreciate the time and energy that it takes to check in with us occasionally. So you don't have any, I guess I forgot to ask, legislative potential here in terms of policies that you need?
For policies, no.
Okay. Okay, the other stuff goes to another committee. Thank you.
On this topic, not so much.
And I said I was going to mention only, we made reference to SJR 6 from the 2007 session. What that was an attempt to deal with the question of we really are hearing here that we are relatively well prepared for emergency response and public health and welfare as best it can be for any magnitude of an event. But the long-term recovery issues, currently most of the authority or all of it resides within the executive branch of government. And what we don't have, from my understanding, in place is a good methodology to bring the legislative role back into this overall conversation should we be unable to follow our normal procedures in terms of how we call an emergency session, or that we physically be able to come to this building if this building is not available to us, or if we're compromised via communication and transportation methodologies. So that joint resolution was an attempt to look at a way to call the legislature into an emergency session in a different manner and perhaps in a different place with a different determination of a quorum depending on who could humanly and physically be here or could communicate by some methodology. And there are constitutional issues involved with that. So it is my intention to at least resurrect the concepts in that bill for further conversation in the next session. If there are constitutional changes required, of course, that will go to a vote of the people. But I think it's something that's important for this committee to look at.
I agree.
What
happened with it?
Well, it was challenging because there are some controversial pieces of that, and it didn't move forward in the 07 session. So, when you're kind of digging around in the Constitution and worrying about who has authority to spend money. And it is certainly challenging.
Interesting.
Yeah, it can get
nice way of putting it.
I'm not suggesting it's an easy question, but it is one that I think we have a responsibility to review. And it was a Senate joint resolution from the 2007 session. There's a copy here, and if anybody wants to look that up, that's where you'd find it.
You want this one?
Sure.
I've got one.
Yes. With that, I believe we are adjourned. Thank you for your...